All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again in the Patron Zone to kick off a new classic reality season rewatch. Dom, I am very excited for this. This is a season I have been looking forward to for what I think I can fairly call years at this point. I think it's been close to at least 2 years since we've been doing these Patron rewatches. Today, we are here to dive into Big Brother 8. How are you doing, Dom?
I'm doing great, but I'm happy for you that you finally get to cross this off the list. And this is officially the Summer of Stone. I'm really going to have a great time.
All right, we should honestly just shut it down here because I am not going to do any better than that over the course of however many hours this ends up taking. But yeah, this is a season. I guess first, before we dive into everything, I did want to just issue a blanket spoiler alert on Big Brother 8 and probably more so, spoiler alert on every Big Brother season Dom or I have seen, and probably Survivor seasons as well. So if you are someone who is new to Big Brother 8 and you want to watch it before you get spoiled on how everything goes, be aware that there will be rampant spoilers not too far from here. So make sure you do whatever you want to do in terms of watching it before you listen any further. But Dom, yeah, I did want to, before we dive into specifics on everything, and to, I guess, keep it spoiler free for a few moments while those people tune it out. This is, as you have alluded to, a season I've been really looking forward to talking about for a while. I guess I alluded to that as well in the intro. But where are you on Big Brother 8 just in the grand scheme of Big Brother seasons before you dive in on this rewatch?
So I first saw BB8, and the last time I saw BB8 was when I was just going through the motions of catching up on these Big Brother seasons. And I think I've seen all of them twice, but in many cases that was fairly soon after the first viewing, because a lot of stuff from the first viewing didn't really stick with me, and I wanted to really embed that in my brain and let the season sink in fully. So I have not seen the season in full in many, many years, you know, probably since we started this podcast, honestly. I couldn't tell you the last time. So I'm not sure how much of what I remember of this season is even accurate. So I have this impression that's been just lying dormant over all these years. And the cast of BB8, like, there have been some Big Brother casts in the past who have, they get brought up in conversation from time to time, but for the most part, their season is in the history books at this point. BB8 is not one of those seasons. You know, this cast is full of big personalities, in many cases awful personalities, who are still stuck in the memory all these years later, and who are still frequent topics of conversation, either because their 15 minutes of fame has still not ended 13 years later, or because, you know, when we discuss old Big Brother seasons, as people like us would want to do, they are natural people to bring up. So this is a season where a lot happens and there's a lot to talk about. And those are two crucial criteria for a good season for something like this. But I wanted to just dive a little deeper on what this season meant for you, because you have been saying to me for a long time, I really want to do BB8. You know, if we never cover another Big Brother season again, I want BB8 to be in that list of seasons that we have covered. And I don't know if for you, I don't want to put words in your mouth, is that just a thing of like, well, it's kind of like just above the Maginot line or whatever in terms of seasons that we ought to cover, but you're not especially enthusiastic? Or is this a true bucket list item for you in terms of talking about it?
Okay, so before I answer that question, I will say now we are entering the spoiler zone. If you don't want to know what happens on Big Brother 8, tune out now. So with that in mind, Dom, it is not a season that I would say stands out for me for what I would consider to be the main reasons most seasons that I consider extremely good stand out to me. And honestly, I'm not even sure if I consider this an extremely good season of reality TV. I just do think that Big Brother 8 has one of the most fascinating storylines that Survivor or Big Brother or any of the shows we've ever really talked about has had go down on its airwaves. And obviously, a big piece of that is, probably, frankly, the entirety of that is because of the two twists that are going to be in play on this season that we'll talk about shortly. But the Dick and Danielle storyline, and this was all happening in, what year would this have been? 2000 and
Seven.
Okay. So I was still, at this point for sure, a filthy, filthy Big Brother casual in terms of I loved watching the TV episodes, but I had no concept of anything really going on the live feeds until about halfway through this season, I would say, or at some point in this season. I spent a little time in Salt Lake City at my sister's house, and she had Showtime 2 or some whatever obscure network these the original iteration of Big Brother After Dark was on. I was
If Showtime is so great, why didn't they make a Showtime 2? Turns out they did. You know, yeah. Showtime was such a resounding success that they had to double down for a sequel.
Well, long, rambly answer, kind of condensed. I would say the Dick and Danielle storyline, when I was consuming it in real time as a very casual viewer, still stands the test of time to me, and even being a much more veteran and jaded viewer, and far less of a particularly Dick Donato fan than I was in real time, I still have found myself enjoying this season the many times that I have rewatched it over the years. I don't want to make it sound like it's just the Donatos that I find interesting. I think many, many things along the way here are very interesting, both strategically and also from a just kind of entertainment perspective. I think this is not the strongest cast in terms of gameplay that I've ever seen, but there are some very interesting characters along the way here. Everything going on with Eric and being America's player, I think, is, while one of the most like overpowered and poorly thought out not necessarily poorly thought out, but going to have, for my money, one of the worst effects on the game, and the producers may be actively into that sort of thing, so I don't want to say it was poorly thought out based on their motivations, but between everything going on in the metagame with the Donatos, everything going on with Eric being America's player, and the very, I would say for the most part, fun and regularly very entertaining other characters along the way, I continue to find Big Brother 8 to be one of the most easily bingeable seasons, I think, of reality TV I've ever encountered. And I do think Big Brother in general it has a tendency, at least for me, to be more easily consumed in massive quantities. Like watching the four episodes of week one of BB8 genuinely felt like only an hour had passed. I mean, this is a season that really flies by. And I, as I said, wouldn't consider this in my like all-time elite pantheon of reality TV seasons, but it is a season that for sure stands out in my memory as a personal favorite. I wouldn't expect the average person to love Big Brother 8, although who knows? I'm not really sure if I have a clear picture on how people generally feel about BB8, but it is definitely one that I think there is an endless amount of interesting stuff to get into on, and I am extremely excited to do so, Dom.
Yeah, I may be less excited than you, and this has been a point of contention between the two of us as the movement for BB8 has grown in the patron group over the past few months, where I wasn't really looking forward to the prospect, because you can frame the season very easily as a story of bad people being rewarded for their bad behavior.
100%.
And the unlikeliest underdogs of all time being just like fashioned out of whole cloth in the service of giving the new producers, our new overlord, Alison Grodner, the storyline that she wants. And, you know, BB8, when we talk about the eras of reality TV, you know, with Survivor, we debate about old school, new school, middle school, however you want to divvy that up. With Big Brother, I think BB8, you could argue, is the beginning of the end in terms of the purity of the game, however much that was really ever there, that we associate with those first seven seasons. BB8 is where the producers learn, the new producers learn, under this lovely new regime, that they can interfere with the game and put their grubby paw prints on the game and get the outcomes that they want and that the audience wants, and that is the recipe for success in Big Brother. You know, the seasons that come after BB8, with a few exceptions like maybe BB10, BB12, they look and feel so different compared to what came before. And part of that is the Donatos getting to the final two, Dick winning the season, and setting the tone for the audience's expectations. And if you're seeing how you can take evil Dick and make him a sympathetic figure, you can make someone who I will say is a bad person, just a terrible person in real life, and who displays how terrible he is in the game of Big Brother. And you can make that person into someone who all of the Facebook fans, all of the online bloggers, as Eric Stein shouts out to, those people are overwhelmingly cheering on Evil Dick. And even the people who don't like him, who are really repulsed by him, they're still tuning into the show. They're hate watching. They're hoping to see him getting taken down a peg, and they're boosting the viewing figures either way. And they have learned that that is how you drive people into watching your show. And we've seen now these people who should, by all accounts, be villains, be vilified, be whitewashed and turned into these heroes time and time again over the course of Big Brother. Since then, we've seen their worst edges just get sanded down until that there's nothing left. And not that that didn't happen in the Shapiro era by any means. Like you see what people said on the live feeds in BB6. You go back. There's always been a treasure trove of gross stuff in Big Brother if you're willing to look for it. But BB8 is where the show leads into glorifying all of that. And so I wasn't sure with that in mind how fun it would even be to watch or talk about the season. And I'm sure there will be episodes where I come in here and derail the conversation by just pointing out stuff that maybe was not aired on the broadcast show, which paints a lot of these people in a very different light, but which is impossible to overlook. But hopefully I can keep the show mostly on the rails and we can have a lot of fun talking about this, regardless of that fact, or in some cases, even because of it. It is fun to have a common enemy.
Well, so I would say please do take the show off the rails and fill me in on whatever has been going on, or was going on, I guess, on the live feeds, because potentially impossible to ignore for the average online super fan, but I have somehow managed to avoid finding out about a lot of the specifics, I guess, of the behavior that was left out of the TV edit. So I would definitely encourage you to bring up whatever you feel is pertinent along the way. And let me just second something you have initially brought up, and I think it is important potentially to make it clear right off the bat the stance that I suspect will be recurring from both of us over the course of this entire season. When we posted that Big Brother 8 was going to be the season we were covering, there was at least some reaction in the patron group about being nervous about us kind of glorifying Evil Dick or talking about him in positive terms over the course of these podcasts. I would definitely not be worried about that sort of thing happening. I absolutely co-signed Dom what you said, and I am in general extremely, extremely reluctant to bring in how the characters we see on TV really are as people unless I feel absolutely certain that I am positive of what I am talking about. And in the case of Evil Dick, I would say there has been maybe no one who has done more to cement himself as someone I am comfortable calling an actively terrible human being on this podcast.
Oh yeah, no reservations about it whatsoever.
Yes, all right. So I guess...
And this is not just because Evil Dick blocked Colin on Twitter many years ago. It is because he is genuinely a terrible human being.
Right. So I guess the way to approach this, and just more generally, I will say, the plan for today is to talk through the twists of the season and whatever else kind of preseason stuff comes up, or just kind of metagame stuff, and then talk through the first day that they are in the house, and we'll get through... Hopefully, like Kale winning HOH and the rivals or whatever we need a better term for that. But the other three who were upstairs the whole time coming down, the plan is to hopefully get to that point today. And then in the next one, we will get through the rest of week one. I will eventually release this down the line on the main feed and probably have both of those together on there. So that will be kind of a seamless transition whenever that happens. But the rest of these, if you are someone listening on the main feed, are going to be available at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. If you would like to sign up to come along with us for the rest of Big Brother 8. But Dom, I think let's kind of start setting up the twists of the season, and let's keep it thematic with the evil dick of it all, and how he and his daughter wound up here together in the first place. We have seen on Big Brother before, like the X Factor on Big Brother 4, the twin twist on Big Brother 5, the pairs twist on Big Brother 6, and then obviously an all returnee season on Big Brother 7. It was a very common thing to have people who knew each other in either good terms or bad terms entering the house together, even in these all newbie seasons. This time around, the way it's going to go is it's people who are either rivals or exes or have some sort of unfinished business. And I would say one of the things probably most worth noting as far as this twist goes is just how different each of these three pairs are. Like, yeah, they all happen to fall into roughly that same category, but we're going to have the pairs of Jess and Carol, who were kind of like high school rivals who just haven't really spoken since they were 16, 17 years old. Dick and Danielle, who are an estranged father and daughter, and then Joe and Dustin, who are exes who do not seem to have a situation that is reparable. And I think it is really easy to see over the very limited time that we get to spend with two of these three pairs just how clear that kind of disparity is. Like with Jess and Carol, I'm not going to say it was like totally neutral, but there certainly wasn't any overbearing animosity, I would say, that would necessarily get in the way of their game, the same way that with Joe and Dustin, it was just so clear, as long as they're both in this house together, this is going to be an issue for both of them 100% of the time. This is never going to go away. They're never going to work together, and they're never going to focus on anything else. And that disparity by itself, I think, is, whether you want to call it fair or unfair, I do think it is glaring. And then we also factor in Dick and Danielle, who I think it is completely insane, as far as I'm concerned, to say they could have anticipated the degree to which they would come together and run the house, even knowing that America's Player is in play. But I would say the two of them were, I would guess, going to go hard either one way or the other. I think it was either going to go very well or very poorly in terms of not necessarily their results in the game, but the dynamic between the two of them. And just when comparing all three of these pairs, I do think it is comparing, sorry, all three of these pairs.
Thank you.
I think it is at least definitely worth flagging up early and often. While they are all kind of lumped together as being part of this same twist, these are massively different relationships that have varying degrees of predictability in terms of how they're going to play out. But I think it is just glaring, again, to me, how different each of these situations are. And in particular, just how, like, hilariously lower key the Jess and Carol thing is than the other two pairs.
Yeah, the pairs are like the Natalie and Nadia of Big Brother Twist, where you have Jessica and Carol, who don't even seem to hate each other all that much. And even when they do, it's totally one-sided. Carol is over it, doesn't even care, doesn't even seem to be that hateful towards anybody. Whereas Jess is really putting in the work to keep that feud going and rekindle it as much as she can. And Carol will go out first eventually, just really putting that fire out altogether. Meanwhile, Dick and Danielle will be the main characters of the season. Their storyline is the story of Big Brother 8, and as you say, they could not have anticipated just how much of a roller coaster their journey would be throughout their time in the house and afterwards, where, you know, a few months after this season, after this incredible reunion and triumph, they're again no longer speaking to each other. And by the time we roll around to BB13 and it looks like the two of them are going to be in the house again, both of them, especially Danielle, are completely dreading the prospect. So that storyline is the story of BB8. And then you have Joe and Dustin, who will also be broken up as a pair very shortly in the season. But while they're there, their conflict is so raw and just so it's kind of gripping in a very uncomfortable way, where we've seen exes on Big Brother before. You know, BB4 was the X Factor. That was the central twist of the season. But even there, most of those pairs, even the ones that still had a lot of unfinished business, a lot of recriminations left to play out on national TV, they felt somehow so much tamer compared to this 2-week episode between Joe and Dustin, where, you know, like June and G end up working together. Erica and Robert hated each other at first, but ended up kind of reconciling and becoming friends again. And then even like the Allisons and Justins of it all, that felt like this was on a totally different level. You know, that those attempts that we saw of Dustin trying to reach out to Joe and Joe's response, and then that turned into a whole relitigation of their relationship. Like, that is almost vintage reality TV. That is what the fans of the medium want it to be, and also what the haters of the medium think that it is. Mm-hmm. It is the most uncomfortable dirty laundry that you can have, just being aired fully on national television.
It is very... I want to begin by saying I feel awful for all six of the people involved in this twist who think they're about to go play Big Brother. And then I'm sure the producers are probably not overstating the degree to which they were unhappy to see whoever their counterpart was come in. And then also, you got to feel awful for Eric Stein just being handcuffed as America's player. So it's really only like half the cast here who are getting to play even close to a clean game here. And by the way,
I do want to see if Eric Stein ever does return to Big Brother, like America as his jilted ex, who, you know, they're not talking anymore, but maybe they can have some gradual uncomfortable reconciliation in the Big Brother house.
Yeah, well, so I think, as I said, maybe they thought there was going to be a lot more to the Jess and Carol dynamic, and maybe they had good reason to believe that for whoever knows why. And I think it is very, very easy to think as a producer that Dick and Danielle could be a compelling source of drama, whether it goes well or goes poorly. But Joe and Dustin in particular are two of the people for whom I feel worse in the entire course of Big Brother history. And I feel very bad for a lot of people in the course of Big Brother history, but this is an absolute nightmare. Like, this is a situation where, like I said, this was going to be priority number one for both of them, and nothing else was ever going to be a close second for as long as they were both in the house. And it was going to be a storyline on the TV show, and it seems like the producers were very, very happy to lean on it very hard in potentially ways that I did not think would necessarily make air so regularly. I'm sure we'll get more into the details along the way, but Joe and Dustin in particular, I feel like there was, setting aside the potential responsibility either of them may have, or accountability they may need to hold themselves to for the situation being this way in the first place, this is the absolute nightmare if you were going on television.
Yeah, and it may be that something this extreme and unexpected is what it took to be able to paint Evil Dick as this heroic figure. You know, you need that redemption arc to turn him into someone that the audience can really relate to. I do wonder, though, in the grand scheme of things, what the reception to Evil Dick would have been had Danielle not been there. And we just see him go in there, terrorizing the other house guests. Or, like, maybe he would have tried to keep it under wraps for the most part, or maybe, you know, his natural inclination to just be a shitty person and yell at people would have jumped out at every opportunity. Hard to say, but either way, this is occurring at a time in the evolution of both Big Brother and Survivor and that corner of the reality TV landscape where there's no kind of set response to this behavior. Like, this is pre-Russell Hans, this is pre other Big Brother contestants who would take Evil Dick's torch and run with it and take this even further to an even worse degree. So I'm not sure coming in what they expected Evil Dick to be. Was he going to be the grimy entertainment that the audience was so desperately looking for, or was he going to be the biggest villain in the history of Big Brother? hard to say, honestly. I don't know what they expected, and frankly, I don't know what he expected.
So I have always felt this way, or the following way, which is Evil Dick in any season as a first-timer. I will absolutely grant that Evil Dick, when he came back for a little while in BB-13, and as a returnee, like in any kind of scenario after BB-8, I do think is a capable kind of player when he has positive meta entering the house among the rest of the cast. But Evil Dick as a first-time unknown player without his daughter there and without America's player in place as another twist on the season, I think is pretty close to 0% to ever win Big Brother as a first time. I think it absolutely requires the game being handed to him to a ludicrous degree for him to have any equity.
It's hard to extrapolate for an entire season based on 1 week of gameplay, but my understanding was that before he left BB13, you know, the early reports from the live feeds, like piecing everything together afterwards, it sounds like he was in almost a crushing spot for those first few days.
For sure.
And was a great job of like unifying the vets and also getting the newbies in line as well. And that is such a
lopsided situation, though.
Of course. And I didn't want to see another season of Evil Dick, but as a thought experiment to see how well he would do in that context, you know, I wanted to see that play out, and it was unfortunately cut short. But yeah, that is not like an unbiased simulation by any means. You know, if you're designing a lab experiment, this is the thing that you put an asterisk by as the exception that does not prove whatever rule you're trying to suggest.
Well, I think Dick is not actively terrible in every single social situation. I definitely think there are many people in this cast who end up liking Evil Dick to varying degrees at certain points. But I don't want to make it sound like he's a Willie Hance type who's just invariably going to blow up to a game-ending degree somewhere along the way. I'm willing to grant that pretty much anyone has equity to win a season of Big Brother in some sort of fluky way, and Dick has definitely shown social talent and strategic acumen at many points along the way in his Big Brother career. I just think it is overwhelmingly, as I'm sure we will talk about very routinely over the course of this season, because of America's player, that Dick ended up winning this season. I think he would have had virtually no chance, even with or without Danielle. And I think the major reason for his success is, as he lays out in an early diary room and as makes air in one of the early episodes, he is in this incredibly just interesting situation where, as much as Danielle may not want to talk to him, he is dying to restore, or I guess rekindle, whatever the right word would be, that relationship. Like, he would very gladly, even though they haven't spoken in 2 years, jump in front of a truck for Danielle. There's nothing within the game of Big Brother that he wouldn't do for her. And he gets a confessional saying, I'm not only here to win the game, I'm also here to win back the love of my daughter. And when America's player is in place, as we will see, that can be a very good way to get a lot of things going your direction, despite Dick obviously not having any idea that was what was happening. It is that story, Dom, that is what I think drew me to BB-8 in such a big way the first time around, back like when I was a casual, is Dick trying to restore this relationship with Danielle. And obviously, I, like the rest of America, was very eager to see how it played out. And I, as this whole season was playing out, was, I'm pretty sure, virtually every step along the way, like, rooting for them and hoping that I would get to see this get this kind of fairy tale ending, because, well, it's Big Brother. It's happening live. How could it possibly be rigged?
I mean, I don't want that relationship to get worse. I'm not rooting for that, but yeah. It's, you know, you have to look at all of the context behind that. But yeah, the reason that Evil Dick gets away with his actions, you know, the worst of his actions in the house, other than just being bailed out by maybe the most game-warping twist in the history of Big Brother, is that he does have, when he wants to, a good social game. He can relate to people. He can joke around, have fun, make them like him, you know, despite whatever age gap there is or difference in background or whatever. He does have that capability, and that both... That makes the worst side of Evil Dick, firstly, more inexcusable, because he clearly can be better and just chooses not to be. But then secondly, it makes that bad side of him even worse when it comes out, because he knows how to push people's buttons. He knows what to say to really cause pain and to tilt people and to get the emotional reaction that he's looking for. You know, he's not an idiot. He's many, many things. But he's not blind to everything that's going on.
No, absolutely. And let's get a little more into just the America's Player factor here, where Eric Stein is going to have to spend this entire summer at least pursuing the missions given to him by America, and the missions themselves, the random kind of tasks he has to do, for the most part, aren't that bad. And I think he would have gladly spent all summer doing the sorts of things like spraying mustard on Jen Johnson's shirt or whatever. I think that would have been a lot of fun. The issue becomes, it's not just, hey, Eric, here's a suggestion from America, and for every three that you successfully accomplish, you get some extra prize money. In the event of the vote and whatever other powers he would end up holding over the course of the season, it's not a suggestion. You are bound to do what America wants to do. And when that is coupled with the Evil Dick and Danielle storyline, this dynamic between a father and daughter in a house full of people who are otherwise either strangers or enemies, already overpowered enough in one respect, now becomes, as you said, I mean, just beyond game breaking. When you combine having Eric, who for my money is hands down the most capable player in the house, we'll see over the course of the summer him repeatedly able to like flip the entire house just at will when he gets some random task from the audience and realizes, oh my god, now everything I've been trying to set up, I have to do the complete opposite and tank my own game, but I don't have a choice. It is incredible to me to it just having that combination of the far and away the most talented player in the house just forced to spend all season long pursuing the Donato's best interest. While this was obviously lost on me in real time, it is just overwhelming what an edge Dick and Danielle had as soon as they were able to get on the same page, which, credit to them, seemed to happen pretty quickly.
We see just how game-warping America's Player can be when it resurfaces for 1 week and 1 week only in BB10,
yes,
where
yeah.
You know, that choice of Memphis versus Jesse is pivotal in that season. And my understanding is that Dan probably would have been on board with voting out Jesse either way. You know, we broke that down in some detail when we covered that week for the BB10 rewatch. But that is the kind of thing where if you flip that one outcome, the entire house and the entire course of the game from that point can change. Like if America wants Memphis voted out there instead, who knows what becomes of Dan Giesling, BB icon and legend, and possibly not BB winner anymore past that point. So that is 1 week, and you see how that can affect the game. And then in this season, you have, again, the exact kind of same dynamic with the Dick and Dustin vote when the two of them are up on the block together, and the most capable player is forced to like flip his vote around to get the outcome which he doesn't want, and then do all the damage control afterwards. And then also every other week in the game is also tainted by America's Player, not to the same exact degree, but you know, every single time there is a pair of players on the block, America chooses who Eric will campaign to vote out, and often that will not align with what Eric would want to do if he had his own druthers.
And add on top of this, the fact, and this is one of my all-time favorite Big Brother stats, the only points at which Dick and Danielle did not have either head of household or power of veto over this entire season were week 4 and week 6. They had this outside Bond, Dick willing to literally die for Danielle and sack his own game for her. They had the only capable player in the house, more or less, constantly forced to work in their own best interest, and they were hands down, as far as I remember at least, maybe this opinion will change over the course of the rewatch, I mean, just dominated all of the competitions. It is insane what a leg up they had in every conceivable way.
Yeah, and not only did they have the best player on their side, that best player had to work for the Donatos without publicly declaring his allegiance to the Donatos. Like, he had to work for them by stealth and then tank his own game by presenting it to the house as if, you know, he was just doing his own thing, which made him look incredibly shady. Like, he couldn't pin it on America. There was no one he could really pin it on. And he knew that his options were so limited that, you know, this is Eric playing the game he was forced to play. And even with that in mind, people are holding him up as one of the best of all time. And so the thought experiment of if he was just given the chance to play Big Brother, like, that, more than anything else, my impression is that is one reason people want an actual All-Star season again, which we haven't seen since the first one, is just to answer that hypothetical, is to see Eric in action and get some indication either way of what he can do when he's not shackled to the fan base.
Oh, I mean, all you really need to know about Eric Stein is even playing under... All you need to know about Eric Stein, the Big Brother player, let me be clear, is even under some of the most grotesque circumstances anyone has ever found themselves forced to play, he still almost won. Like, he was constantly able to get people thinking the way he wanted to, then gets an envelope from America where he finds out he has to undo all of the work he had just done to pursue his own interest in order to shift things the Donatos' direction for increasingly random reasons as far as the rest of the house is concerned. He's taking these extraordinarily weird lines with every single other player because his priorities are constantly being forced to shift from his own interest over to Dick and Danielle. And even with all of that working against him, he still almost won. And I would frankly say if the competitions just fall into exactly the same hands, but that final five doesn't happen to be a live show, I really feel like there is just no way he doesn't convince Zach to use the veto, I guess would be the way to do it, and take out one of the Donatos at that point. If Zach has more than 30 seconds to think through that decision, I think it is a very easy one.
Yeah, I'm not so sure Eric does actually convert from that point. Like, there's a chance that Danielle just curbs dumps her in many competitions, and she would have no intention of taking Eric at that point.
But the way it took crazy circumstances for him to even leave is what I mean.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. One final thing before we dive into the actual specifics here, and let's weave in some positivity when we can, because I'm sure with Evil Dick being such a central figure here, we may be dwelling on the negative from time to time. I will say this about Big Brother 8 and the beginning of the Grodner era, which for my money is the obvious undoing of Big Brother as a franchise, is Alison Grodner taking over. The Big Brother 8 house itself, the Alice in Wonderland themed, is
the Alice in Grodner Wonderland.
Yeah, all right, I love it. Is for my money, and I have not seen the most recent couple of seasons of Big Brother, so who knows if they've done something really awesome there. But as far as BB2 through BB19 are concerned, the no-brainer, the Survivor Gabon, if you will, location of the Big Brother 8 themes is this Big Brother 8 Alice in Wonderland house. This is awesome, and this theme all season long is very cool.
Yeah, BB Can has made a good case for itself over the years as well, but of the American seasons, especially given, you know, when this was occurring, yeah, this house is a cut above the rest.
Yeah, so I agree with you for sure that BB Can does a stellar job, although... in the context of this discussion, I will say BB Can is not BB Cannon. All right. Dom, let us now dive, I suppose, through the looking glass into the actual goings-on here in Big Brother 8. We have 11 people enter as Dick, Jess, and Dustin, three halves of this twist, have already entered like earlier that afternoon and have been locked upstairs for... Not really sure how long, although I would guess Dick was very eager to get a cigarette after about 10 minutes being in that HOH room and was not interested in staying there all afternoon. But we have these original 11 enter. They go, they pick out their beds, they do the whole living room. Sorry, go ahead.
And in the process, all of these lumbering behemoths who are like 6'3" have to crouch down to fit through the doorways and make sure they don't bang their heads. But our short king, Eric Stein, can just wander through the house with no trouble at all. So, yeah, already has a leg up coming into day one.
There's never been a better season on which to be 5'7" or what? It's not to whatever he is. I'm sorry. It's hard to tell whenever the other guy in the house is like 6'5". But yeah, we meet our 11 players. We get the classic Big Brother intro package. There's some highlights in there. I love Zach with his comment about how I'm Zach and I'm gonna outthink the rest of the house as he like forcefully slams a pawn down on the chessboard. And credit to Zach, as I'm sure we'll get into a little bit early in week one here, like as the whole Mrs. Robinson alliance ends up forming, it does actually seem like Zach is kind of a central player within the political game, and he does end up making a very deep run, obviously, on this season. It's just that decision at Final Five that really stands out to me as what makes this such a retrospectively comical kind of statement from Zach, as he like willingly lets the most powerful duo in Big Brother history make it to the Final Four together.
I'm going to mull over in my mind if I'm going to have a volcanically hot take on that decision when it comes down to it, but I haven't decided yet, so
okay.
Stay tuned for that.
Okay, maybe you may be onto something. It's been a long time since I've seen this season, so maybe I'm living in a revisionist world here, a pro-Eric Stein revisionist world here, but I also loved the only other thing that really stood out to me from the intro packages is Jamaica drives a PT Cruiser, which I did not see coming, but that was, I thought, worth noting. Any Big Brother contestant driving a PT Cruiser is a major blindside to me, but
why is that?
Do you know what a PT Cruiser is?
Vehicle of some kind.
Neither here nor there.
So let me in on the scoop here.
So a PT Cruiser was a vehicle that they made from, I don't know, 2003 to 2000 and let me see, maybe they still make the PT Cruiser now that I'm thinking about it, and I just haven't I'm gonna look up the exact stats here on when the PT Cruiser was or continues to be in all right, here we go. Okay, here we go. Not bad by me. It was made from 2000 to 2010, and it was, so there was some sort of massive redesign in 2006. It is not entirely unlike the Pontiac Aztec, Dom, in terms of just its lore in car history.
Okay, so why is it so
its
stunning
place
that Jamaica
in car
has
history.
One?
Sorry if lore is the wrong word there.
The canon, is that? No, that's not a thing. But okay, yeah, good for Jamaica. Wonder what wheel she has at the moment. Any other car-related standouts from this?
We don't need
sequence?
To spend... Yeah, no, I probably didn't need to even go down that rabbit hole in the first place, but the original 11, I love... Like, this genuinely never gets old to me when they find out that there are other people in the house. Joe, I believe, is the one to suggest, all right, guys, before we find out who it is, original 11, right? Whoever it is, the original 11 of us are all going to stick together. I love... In Big Brother, I guess it could happen on Survivor in extreme circumstances, but I never get sick of the people sincerely trying to keep a group of like eight or more intact is hysterical every time.
The Chris Noble strategy.
To be fair, I don't think this, yes. I don't think this lasts more than 15 seconds, even in Joe's mind. It's just so funny to see it even thrown out there.
And of course it's going to be Joe, right? Like, it would make sense if it was, you know, one of these players who is about to be blindsided by their exes or by their, you know, life partner, for lack of a better word, life nemesis, coming back in. But Joe just seems like the type who is going to be making a move this blatant this quickly.
Yes. And by the way, I guess before we are back finding out about the exes, I totally confused my timelines here because they do... the original meet and greet on the couch. They then go play the first HOH competition, and then we go back to the couch and find out about, not necessarily, I shouldn't call them all exes, because I guess that's only the case for one of the pairs, but still looking for a better term of what to call these duos of people. But Dom, I guess let's, before we get into everyone trying to, the original 11 wondering who's about to come around the corner downstairs from the HOH room and ruin their summer, let's do talk through this first head of household competition. Not the most exciting opening HOH in Big Brother history, but it is a format that I like. I definitely remember them doing this exact same thing in, I guess it would have been Big Brother 5 at the very least, where they're teamed up, where someone's answering questions and someone else is on a treadmill. And there may have been other instances. I want to say BB3, one of the HOH comps, if not the opening HOH comp, they were playing in pairs. This used to be a fairly standard thing where one pair would become the winner of like the main game, and then the odd people out would determine which of the two people in that pair would be the first head of household. And in this case, Dom, one person is going to be answering random kind of questions about the other people in the house that are basically coin flips, and the other person is going to be spinning around on a mushroom, kind of sticking with the Alice in Wonderland theme. We get a very well-decorated Lewis Carroll backdrop in our backyard here for this competition. And despite Eric at a certain point actively trying to get the questions wrong, he keeps fluking into the right answer. And on top of that, Kale, his partner, just refuses to let go of this mushroom. So as badly as he wants to be eliminated from this head of household competition, it comes down to Eric and Kale as our winning pair here. And the three people that the rest of the house haven't gotten to see yet who are still up in the HOH room are going to be the ones determining which of these two is going to be the first HOH. And Eric Stein cannot possibly do more to try to suggest to them that it should be Kale.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for these HOH competitions where people are just stuck together against their will, and they have completely different priorities in the game, different personalities, maybe on different sides of the house, and they just have to find a way to either make it work or like throw it. But then in Eric's case, it's even better because he tries his best to throw it and he can't. I love the Jason Janelle twist from week one of All Stars. So anything like this is guaranteed to get a thumbs up from me.
Yes, and fortunately for Eric, he does get his way. He openly pleads with, "Hey, if the people who are deciding are watching, please pick Kale. You know, she did all the work. She should definitely be the first HOH." He does manage to fade that. So Kale is going to be our first head of household of the summer.
I do actually wonder if Eric had tried his best and failed to throw this comp, and he had been forced to be HOH. I wonder who America at this very early point in the season would have chose to put up, because even here we're getting some sympathy for the Nanos. You can kind of rule some people out, but I don't know who America had really taken a disliking to at this early stage. Like maybe Joe, maybe I don't know, honestly.
So I would guess Joe would be one of them, as I do feel like he was in the early weeks here portrayed as kind of the one being relentless about dragging Dustin, and Dustin was more kind of even keeled, having heartfelt talks with people in the hammock, just trying to get past everything. I would imagine Joe would be one of them. And then also, as we'll go on to see early in week two, when Eric gets his first assignment to nominate someone or to go campaign for someone to be nominated for eviction, Jessica is the first name that comes out of that envelope. I'm sure a lot of that was impacted by her kind of being on the gloating side of everything that will end up going down here with Carol, but it wouldn't shock me if she were the other one who was an early nominee for Eric. And you know, again, he would have no choice, I would imagine, about either of the nominees if he had, in fact, been picked to be the first HOH here. And I cannot even conceive of what a nightmare that would be, to have to spend however many days strategizing with people, developing bonds, potentially, I would assume, forming some alliances if you were the initial HOH, and you don't even get control, or you don't even get to find out for a little while who your nominees are going to be. That is an absolute Big Brother nightmare. And I feel like I've described many things at this point as an absolute Big Brother nightmare for several people within this cast already.
One of the most relatable, one of the most interesting aspects of Big Brother in a big picture sense to me has always been how people perceive themselves in the house, how they think America perceives them, and how that overlaps with the reality of who they actually are in the house versus what gets shown on the TV show and then highlighted by fans on social media and forums and so on. And all of that takes on a much greater importance on this season with America's Player. And in the future, we're going to have twists which are very explicitly placed into the game to benefit the fan favorites and just outright rigging in favor of them, or America gets a chance to have some influence, and of course that's going to go towards the people that either they like the most. But in this season, I do wonder how, if you just drop the bombshell that Eric was America's Player, or that someone in the house was America's Player, that this kind of influence was being had, I wonder how people's actions and perceptions of themselves and each other would have changed. Like, would Jess in the diary room be even more catty about Carol, or less catty about Carol because she's worried about how things are going to be taken? Like, is Jen, does Jen have the self-awareness to realize how she's being, how she's coming across, and does she lean into that, or does she back away from it? Like, that kind of stuff is always at the forefront of my mind when I watch a season like this.
Yeah, and I think this idea of who was popular with America was certainly it's something that was talked about in depth in the house over the years leading up to this, for sure. But I would say this is one of the most formative seasons in cementing in the minds of future Big Brother players just how vital it is to be on America's good side. And I think, like, in a modern Big Brother season, and this is one of the things that eventually got me to just stop tuning out of the show entirely, there is just active pandering to get America on your side, because at a certain point they're going to have some crazy power. I haven't seen enough of the very recent seasons to say this with any kind of confidence, but I would at least imagine it is very difficult to win a modern season of Big Brother without the producers actively wanting you to win.
Yeah, and if you are a Big Brother contestant in this era, even if the America's Player twist in this season is conceived and executed perfectly without any flaws, and you trust the upper management to know what they're doing here and to uphold the purity of the game, insofar as this twist even can do that to begin with, if you're on like BB9 or BB10, which I guess in BB10 you would be justified in having this concern, at least for one
week. Michelle was all over it.
Yeah, Michelle just reams out Dan for being America's Player even before he was taking on those responsibilities and afterwards as well. But I wonder how long you would have to go without seeing this kind of twist in the game to stop worrying about it and to stop consciously changing the way you interact with the diary room and the cameras and the live feeds and so on with that in mind. Like, you can't put this twist into the game and have it just be a one-off thing, because everyone is justified in being concerned about this now for the rest of the show's existence.
No, absolutely. And I was actually thinking earlier today, as I was beginning the week two episodes, I genuinely am like watching ahead on these episodes. That's how into this season I am, Dom. I non-ironically very much enjoy every single rewatch of Big Brother 8 that I go through. But I was literally thinking to myself, because I remember for sure Eric saying somewhere at some point that obviously if he had declined the role of America's Player, he would not be able to be on that season because he would know about the twist. And part of the reason he took it was he did not have a guarantee that he would be able to get on some future season. So he knew it was either you can 100% go on right now if you are willing to do this, or not, and then you may or may not hear from us in the future. I was actually
it's the same thing as the mole, right? You are being cast as the mole, and that is your offer. You know, take it or leave it.
Not necessarily. I mean, because they could still put you as a regular contestant, and you would know, obviously, a mole is in place when you're on a show called The Mole.
Sure, yeah.
But for America's Player, like The Saboteur, actually The Saboteur is another one where you could probably decline it and still potentially get a spot on that same season. But in Eric's case, and it's a no-brainer that obviously you can't offer it to someone and then still put them on the show the same season if they decline. But an angle I was thinking of for any kind of future Big Brother players, I do think it could potentially be compelling now, even in the year 2020 or whenever the next Big Brother season happens, is whoever's in there could take the line at some point if they want to just kind of cast suspicion upon someone else, say to another kind of super fan within the house, hey, a few years ago, I went through the casting process. They said they were going to do they were potentially thinking about doing America's Player again, and they wanted it to be me. I said, hell no. They didn't end up using that twist, but they couldn't put me on the season anyway. But I think, you know, a couple of years have passed, and that person is looking really sketchy. I think they might be America's Player.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I'm surprised. Like, we see Michelle in a fit of rage just try and get Dan to confess that he's America's Player. But I'm surprised that we don't see that tactic get used more often over the broad course of Big Brother, where, you know, framing someone as America's Player seemed like it'd be a great way to just, you know, even if they don't buy it immediately, just casting that suspicion, putting that seed in their head and letting it germinate.
I really wonder what the rules would allow in terms of lying as things pertain to, like, secret powers within the house. Like, would that be something where they would just immediately hit you with the house guest, no talking about production, and that's every single time you try to attempt it, you get yelled at?
Maybe. I guess maybe it wouldn't work so well because everybody wants to believe that they themselves are popular, and that if there was America's Player in the game, that would be great because America is going to love me and do everything they can to put that $500,000 into my hands. So, you know, people believe what they want to believe. So I guess it wouldn't work so well, but definitely something to have in the arsenal when the time comes.
Yeah, and to go back to the original question you asked 10 minutes ago about the idea of just making it known to the house that America's Player is in play, I think would, first of all, of course, be a complete game breaker to an equal but much different extent than it is as a secret, but it could also have, it is, at least as far as I'm concerned, drastically more likely to have the opposite effect of the one it will have when it remains a secret, which is America's favorites just benefiting constantly despite no one in the house having any reason to understand why everything might be breaking their way. Versus if the whole house knows something like this is in play, even setting aside who America's Player specifically is, I would imagine some part of the strategy would be if too much starts going someone's way, we got to take them out because obviously America's helping them too much.
I know this goes completely against the integrity of the show, but I've always kind of liked it in a way when people get to hear like the audience reaction or the clapping or the booing when a vote gets cast or a twist gets announced or something, and just seeing people lose their minds, unpacking the implications of that in terms of who's well liked, who's disliked, am I well liked, am I disliked, and I've always thought it'd be fun for the producers to just kind of mess with people by, like, I don't know, have like an applause track or something you can play at opportune times during the live show, just to put these ideas in people's heads and get them thinking.
I mean, it's not an applause track, but I think one of the kind of very broken pieces of Big Brother in recent years, and at first it was just annoying and then got to the point, I genuinely believe, of like actively interfering with the game, is the return of the live audience, where I wouldn't care that much about it one direction or the other if it was somehow like soundproof, but like we know that the contestants can hear audience reactions to them casting their votes. They can hear big cheers or loud boos in certain cases to people casting votes in the diary room during the live shows. We've definitely heard over the years people can hear reactions from the audience to competitions like post live eviction, head of household things.
Well, and just to give the perfect example of that, I've been watching Kevin Martin's rewatch of his own winning Big Brother Canada season, BB Can 5, which I would definitely recommend watching along with that as and when he does it. That's been a lot of fun. And one of the things he said was that, you know, Cindy ends up making this massive flip on Netta. And one reason why is that as the, you know, there was audience reaction on the live show being played for one of these comps when, you know, it wasn't soundproof properly. And people were like audibly cheering when Netta dropped out of the competition, and that both sent Netta into a slump for the remainder of her time in the house, and also, you know, gave the people who were working against Netta and Cindy, who had this big decision to make, the impetus they needed to really rev it up and make that move.
The Netta eviction vote is one that I stopped watching BB Can 5 shortly after this point, not as like out of solidarity with Netta or whatever. The game just didn't continue to interest me. But when Netta is being voted out, that may be the like number one all-time example on like the audience decibel meter of like every single person who voted out Netta could hear an enormous cheer from the audience through Arissa's mic.
Yeah, and how does that season change if like some mischievous person in production is like piping that audio when Aiko drops out of the competition, or you know, there's so many alternate timelines you can conjure up here, but it really does impact the game. And honestly, with the depth that the show is willing to go to in other ways, I'm surprised they haven't pushed that angle more of just messing with the contestants' heads like that.
Yeah, hey, maybe we will dig deep in the weeds here in the BB-8 streets, Dom, and find out that Grodner herself is the one who sent this helicopter or this airplane banner over the BB-8 house. She was trying to blow up Eric's somehow.
Oh, we got a banner truther in here.
I don't know why it would serve her to expose the twist that was helping the best storyline for the season, but I feel like we can get there. We can talk ourselves into some sort of conspiracy here, some sort of next level MK Ultra deep state kind of goings on.
Hey, we've got some time. We can brainstorm this and really lock it down.
Yeah, all right. So Kale, as mentioned a little while ago, is going to be our first head of household here. And we are not going to get too much into the decision in terms of nominations and evictions today. But I did think Kale would be another interesting person to check back in on in the context of what... in the context of when you were asking me who I thought could potentially be a week one nominee if Eric was the person who ended up being chosen to be HOH here by the odd three out, where I would imagine after being partners with Kale and getting to that point with her in the competition, they would make some sort of agreement either before one of them was chosen or shortly thereafter that obviously, you know, we did this competition together, we're going to keep each other safe. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Kale, after that comment about how she wouldn't want her, she'd be like heartbroken if her kids came to her and told her that they were, quote, and these are her words, not mine, choosing to live a gay lifestyle, end quote, that would like wreck her life. I could definitely see that earning her a week one nomination, which could have been extremely awkward for Eric if he gave her some sort of assurance that obviously she would not go up after getting him to that point.
I know you said over the years that Marcellus's mom, during their like home check-in segment in BB3, essentially disowning him for being gay on national TV and is one of the most shocking things we've seen in any Big Brother season, and I completely co-sign that. And this isn't quite on the same level, just because as far as I know, none of Kale's children are publicly out. Although if they weren't publicly out before, Kale saying that on national TV sure isn't helping things. But yeah, that, I mean, I'll let you speak on that, but yeah, that comparison to me has always stood out, and that is one of the more underrated, forgotten, like shocking Big Brother moments in my mind.
Yeah, well, I haven't rewatched Big Brother 3 in probably a solid decade, but when they do...
It's pretty good. You should check it out.
Yeah, thanks. When they do the home check-in, yeah, I will never forget it. This is one of the most memorable, and not in a good way, obviously, but just because it is so jarring, it really stands out to me. When they check in with Marcellus's family, and it's many, many weeks into the season. He is a really big character. America is, I think, for the most part, liking him overall. He's clearly having a lot of fun in there. We check in on, you know, Marcellus and the home life that he left behind and what his family thinks of how he's been doing over the course of the summer. And, you know, normally these are extraordinarily supportive. It's, hey, you know, happy to see him in there having, or whoever our loved one is in there having fun, doing their best. We're super proud of them. And instead, we get Marcellus's mom like, hey, I'm happy he's having fun in the Big Brother house, but like, no, I've been really not cool with Marcellus ever since he came out as gay. This has been something that's really fractured our relationship, and I will never come to terms with that being the reality of his life and now my life. And even all these years later, I mean, I can still visibly see in my mind, Dom, Marcellus's mom. I can picture her. I can see her face now thinking about this, having not seen this clip in a very, very long time. That to me, and I'm sure it stood out less probably in the year 2002 or whatever it was when many people were firmly of that belief. And, you know, Rudy Bosch was on TV not too long ago talking in similarly judgmental terms, at least during the early days, about gay people. It definitely remains a vivid memory for me, that Marcellus's mom kind of check in. And I had that same reaction to watching Kale this time around. I didn't remember that being something that stood out to me in a major way watching this back in 2007 or whatever, but I definitely remember wincing at that quote every subsequent rewatch.
I don't know if Marcellus has ever really spoken publicly about this, but I have to imagine that is just like scarred in his memory from that season, as were other moments in Big Brother 3 involving Marcellus that, you know, have gone down as iconic for other reasons. But yeah, it's like coming out of that, how does that not fuck you up mentally to have your own parents do that to you? And I guess it's not like that was any secret to Marcellus or she felt that way, but even so, I have to imagine that was just like, you know, when you stack up your Big Brother experience, you know, close to 20 years later now, that still has to be a big part of it. And that is really unfortunate.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm guessing this is even more unfortunate, that reaction from his mom is not specific to when he's in the Big Brother house. I'm sure that's been something that has been a big point of contention between them the entirety of the time that he's been out. I would be very surprised if she has come around at all, even to this day. And I'm laughing about it because it's super uncomfortable. But yeah, it is I mean, so far beyond anything either of us could even conceive of, I would imagine, that I feel deeply uncomfortable even commenting on it to, as if I could relate to it. But yeah, I mean, it is a complete, I feel like I've been using the word nightmare a lot over the course of these podcasts, but I mean, that is beyond anything I could ever even conceive of. And I'm sure Marcellus has had a lot of his development defined by that sort of reception from his parents. And hopefully no one hearing this is that way towards their own kids. But anyway, Dom,
How that stacks up compared to your ex declaring on national TV that you immaculately conceived gonorrhea is, you know, will remain to be seen over the course of the next few episodes here. But anything else on this introduction before we get out of here?
Well, I did want to just say one final note. Speaking of exes immaculately conceiving gonorrhea, after they come back inside and get back on the couches to check in with Julie, now that Kale is head of household, I'm totally messing up the sequence of events here, because I guess they must have found out that other people were in the house prior to this, because Eric was pleading with those people in the backyard not to pick him to be head of household. So I guess they go back in kind of knowing they're about to get the reveal. And this I thought was hysterical.
And we do also say them saying when they get in, there are only 11 people here. This isn't a modern cast of Big Brother where we're just summarily executing someone on night one just for the fun of it. Something's not adding up. There's got to be a twist going on here.
Right, and this is when Joe starts saying, all right, whatever's about to happen, the 11 of us, we should stick together, right? Original 11, let's go for it. And again, I don't think even Joe thought that that was a realistic possibility more than 10 seconds after he said it. I think it was just an impulsive kind of thing to say. But one thing that he did recognize as a very real possibility as soon as he heard that the twist was three people are about to come downstairs and one of you is going to recognize each of them because it's someone with whom you have some sort of negative history or unfinished business. And Joe, at least on the TV episodes, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if this was the case in real time, cannot quickly enough get in front of what he knows is about to happen, which is, guys, one of them's going to be my ex, Dustin, and it is going to be a disaster. I cannot explain to you the kind of bad terms that me and this guy are on at this moment. I have dragged his name through all of Chicago. It is a nightmare, Dom, to stick with the theme. It is going to be absolute chaos for as long as the two of us are in the house together. I am already, before I've even seen his face, campaigning for him to be leaving, and this never really subsides between Joe and Dustin until one of them is gone.
Yeah, and I'm sure Carol, if she had been so minded, could have said, okay, if it's any one of these 15 different people from my past who I had a mild argument with in eighth grade, then I'm sure we'll be okay, but just be mindful of that just in case. You know, she is not even understanding the possibility maybe that she could be involved in this twist too. Although, yeah. I actually, because with Dick and Danielle, we know that they had applied together, I think it was for BB6, before they had this big falling out. And they knew effectively that the other one was going to be there, even though Dick hadn't come down the stairs yet. And then with Joe and Dustin, Joe, he knew instantly that Dustin was going to be involved. I'm not sure if Carol had any like inside scoop on that, or if anybody else was genuinely concerned that, oh God, this model nemesis of mine from my real life is going to come in here and potentially sour this entire experience for me.
So I had, first of all, had not known that Dick and Danielle had talked about doing another season together prior, although that definitely checked. I knew Dick had been a finalist for some other season prior to this one, and I guess it would have had to be. He said, yeah, that, you know, I was a finalist and then they did All Stars the year after that. So, of course, BB6 would be the one. But from Danielle's perspective, I suspect when she was doing the BB8 casting and as she was getting her key and about to go walk out to enter the house, I think she was at least hoping, if not leaning, that it was more likely than not that she could potentially be there by herself. I wouldn't be blown away if they just told her, hey, you know, it didn't work out with you and your dad going in as a pair, but we really want you to come in for this next season that we're going to do. I don't think she thought it was necessary. I would imagine, at least, she didn't think it was a foregone conclusion that her dad was going to be there. But as soon as she heard, hey, there are three more people coming in and they're not going to be fun faces for a couple of you guys to see, I'm sure she was locked in. Obviously, my dad's about to walk down the stairs.
And for her, it seemed to be more of a stunned silence and just not knowing how to process that sudden news versus Joe, who is instantly just, you know, kind of running with it almost and dropping the bombshell and getting out ahead of it before Dustin can even introduce himself to his future castmates.
Joe genuinely seems to want to have Dustin on the block before he's even walked down the stairs. But
yeah,
like,
Dustin is going to be the night one eviction, you know, whether it's because he's getting put up or because he's going to quit under, you know, psychological torture from Joe.
Yeah, and maybe Joe thought a good move was trying to just annoy and berate Dustin into quitting, and he could, like, get to play the game on his own. But I would, to go back to the Dick and Danielle and what Danielle may have been thinking, I would guess if Danielle showed up, saw that there were 11 people, thought something was weird, and still thought her dad might be involved, would not have lied about her age.
Oh, just because you know that Dick, if he is so minded, could just spill the beans and ruin that for you?
If you think it is more likely than not that your dad is somehow involved in this season, I would imagine she would err on the side of caution there. Although we do see, I don't think at any point that even goes on to be an issue. We get a clip of her saying,
No one's even going to care. This is in the same category as Kale lying about being a multi-business owner, Colin, which, you know, that will, you know, Kale will have a tough time of it this season, and that has nothing to do with it whatsoever. You know, that is completely irrelevant.
Well, I'm sure Kale pulled herself up by her bootstraps to make all of that happen and have half the town working for her in her mid-30s or whatever. But yeah, I'm sure you are absolutely right that it was very much at the back of both Dick and Danielle's minds that the other one could be there. I would be pretty surprised if either of Carol or Jess or Joe or Dustin went through too much of the casting process thinking that this was going to be something in play for them. But do you have any kind of behind-the-scenes info there or any other kind of behind-the-scenes info that would be relevant for this portion of the podcast?
Absolutely not.
Okay, cool. I mean, live feeds haven't even started yet, so not a whole lot of behind-the-scenes action that has been reported to get into. But, Dom, I will say, over the course of this season, that will be your territory, is finding out the behind-the-scenes stuff. I am very bad at sifting through hundreds of pages of Joker's updates from 20 years ago, 10 years ago.
I have no inclination to do that either, so I'm putting the call out there. If you know or you have a good source for, like, behind-the-scenes info on BBA, and by behind-the-scenes, I don't just mean the stuff that wasn't even on the live feeds. I mean just, like, pertinent stuff from the live feeds that makes you see either the people in the game or the events in the game in a new light and gives necessary context. And by all means, get in touch with that and let us know, because we want to be coming to this from an informed place.
Yeah, if you are Zach and you want to tell us everything that happened behind the scenes, please hit us up.
A little Zach perspective to wrap it up.
Yeah. All right. So, Dom, I'm sure we will be addressing many more kind of big picture stuff that could have potentially fit in here that we just forgot to get to today along the way. But anything else that you are dying to bring up before we sign off here?
I'm all good.
All right. Well, thank you guys, of course, for continuing to support the podcast. And at least I, and hopefully Dom, am looking forward to continuing down this rabbit hole in the what universe does Alice in Wonderland take place in? Is it some made up country, or is it just England or America or what?
My first response was Narnia, which might be
that's what I'm asking. Is there a Narnia equivalent of Alice in Wonderland?
No, I meant, my first thought was, it literally is Narnia. That's the answer that we're looking for, which I'm assuming by your reaction is conclusively not the case.
I'm pretty sure, can you pull C.S. Lewis out of Lewis Carroll? Is that like a potential national treasure unlocking that I just did, that actually it's the same person writing all these books?
Sure, let's go with it. We can make something work with that.
All right. Well, I guess that investigation will be underway going forward, so be on the lookout there. For the people in the non-patron zone, I guess this is going to kind of seamlessly transition into the rest of our week one conversation. For the actual patrons, that will be coming in a couple of days now in real – or however many days now in real time, although I am excited, Dom, to get back into this very quickly, and I think we should be able to get these going pretty routinely. We knocked the mole out very quickly, so hopefully I have a lot more coming on this front in the very near future. Until then, we will be doing whatever we end up deciding to do on the main feed. Dom, what's going on in terms of what we want to do for the Survivor auction off season? Well, on the main feed, in terms of, do you have any ideas yet?
put me on the spot here. I don't have any ideas yet. I will try and come up with some, because we have a lot of time to do that right now.
Okay. Well, send us if anyone has ideas for what they think would be compelling kind of main feed content during this indefinite Survivor hiatus. We are very open to suggestions there. With all of that out of the way, we will talk to you guys very soon. Take care, everybody. Right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are yet again to get into some more Big Brother 8. Here to talk more about the rest of week one. Dom, how are you feeling this week?
I'm feeling good. How are you?
I'm feeling very good. Actually, before we get into the rest of week one, and I don't want to spend forever on this because we certainly have quite a bit to get to today, but Dom, this is the one question I really care most, I think, this week about hearing your honest answer on. I will put it out there at the top of the podcast. I don't care if you blatantly lie to my face for every other question I ask you the rest of how long this takes, but I would like the true scoop as far as you are concerned, just to this point. I know it's only been four episodes in terms of how much we will have covered by the end of this podcast. I have been watching a little ahead. I don't know if you have been, but just through those first four episodes, I would love to know your genuine reaction to this point, just in terms of how much you're enjoying it. Am I crazy for looking forward to this season to the extent that I have been, as far as you're concerned, or are you getting at least a reasonable amount of fulfillment out of this rewatch yourself?
You could have just asked me, are you having fun this season? And I could have shaved a lot of time off, but yeah,
I'm sorry.
I'm going to pretend that's what you asked me and say, yeah, it's a fun season so far. And I don't know if and when this changed, or if maybe I have too rosy or not rosy enough memories of certain other seasons, but I wonder what the inflection point was when, to me at least, the edited show, the one that would air three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, whatever the days ended up being on, where that product became essentially unwatchable for me. And that really hampered my ability to watch and enjoy Big Brother, whether it's US, Canada, whatever, because, you know, I'm not someone who either had easy access to the live feeds or especially enjoyed watching the live feeds. I found that I couldn't really enjoy it as some kind of background material. So for me, if I was going to follow a Big Brother season, it was going to be through those episodes or through just catching snippets in my Twitter timeline and trying to piece things together based on that. And so that has had to become the default strategy nowadays, if and when I choose to follow it at all. Whereas, you know, we went back and watched and enjoyed BB7 primarily just by watching the edited show. And then here, this season is off to a good start. BB10, I thought the episodes there were a lot of fun. So I don't know if I'm just not appreciating exactly how much they left out, or, and we said that, like, obviously Dick and Danielle are going to get far rosier an edit than either one of them deserves at this point, especially Evil Dick. But by and large, it feels like this TV show that I'm watching feels like a good TV show, as opposed to BB, you know, whenever we get into the double digits, where it really feels like a chore sometimes.
Oh, yeah. And one thing I kind of definitely mentioned in passing in the first part that we did, but I am now kind of thinking about in slightly different terms after something you just referenced, is I remember thinking to myself that BB8 is a season that has always stood out to me as certainly one that I have fond memories of, at the very least. But for, I would say, very different reasons than the average season that stands out in my memory as being exceptional for one reason or another. Like, there are many, many things about Big Brother 8 that kind of, on a fundamental level, I deeply object to. And I would probably say, and this is kind of the thought that you just sparked in my mind, this is perhaps the best time for either of us to be rewatching Big Brother 8 and enjoying it for kind of like maximum value. I'm not sure what word, I'm sure what terminology I'm kind of looking for there, but I do think the more time that has been put between us and the last point at which we really found ourselves enjoying Big Brother at all is going to benefit these seasons that we're rewatching on these patron episodes, for these patron episodes, I guess, and allow us to really be in a headspace where we're looking for the fun elements, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And incidentally, I feel like another thing that I wanted to say in terms of how I may have not done an adequate service in illustrating one of the major points I was hoping to address in kind of the season kickoff podcast is, I do think we got kind of bogged down in a lot of what was going on with the Donatos, and it's understandable why when we're talking a lot of big picture stuff last week, and they're going to be the bulk of a lot of the main story here. But I did talk about that whole saga and this estranged father-daughter duo rekindling that bond, and this guy who would literally jump in front of a moving bus to protect this this daughter of his. I do find that obviously extremely compelling, much more so than the average interaction between strangers can generally provide on a Big Brother season. But I do think it bears getting at least on the record and hopefully expanded upon relatively soon, that there is a ton of non-Donato stuff that I think really does elevate this season above the average Big Brother season. And that is, I hope, so, plenty of what we can be getting into today and in a lot of these other earlier week podcasts. Like, I think obviously there is a ton to be saying along the way about everything that goes on with Dick and Danielle, but and I feel like we said this a lot about Big Brother 10 as well. In rewatching these early episodes, it is really standing out to me how much I have been, I think, at least in my memory, kind of sleeping on the rest of this cast. There is an endless supply, as far as I'm concerned, of really funny character segments all along the way here, especially in these early episodes. And I think there's a lot to be getting to here today, Dom.
Even some of those disposable players who go out in the early weeks and don't make a big impression, they at least make a temporary big impression for the week or two where they go down in some blaze of glory. And that's all that we can really ask for them.
Oh, whereas, I mean, Joe Barber is a perfect illustration of that. Like, across the course of Big Brother history, someone who is rarely going to make it far, but is going to be amazing as long as he's there.
See, I didn't even have Joe on my mind when I said that, but he is the perfect example. I was thinking more of someone like Mike, who, fittingly, given his profession, is like watching paint dry sometimes, but he really he steps it up and does us all a solid in his eviction week, by which would not have been his eviction week under any normal circumstances if he had kept his mouth shut and just sat there and looked pretty. But instead, he decided to just tank his own game in public in full view of everybody and at least give us some entertainment on his way out the door.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we will be getting more into plenty of these non-Donato characters here as we work our way through the rest of week one. Maybe Mike less so. Maybe this isn't his week to shine, but definitely more coming his way down the line, I'm sure. Dom, one other thing, just before we get into the specifics, and I just wanted to check in with you on, is something we've talked about, I'm sure, in other Big Brother podcasts, but it is just so refreshing to me every time in these, at this point, what I would consider conclusively kind of like old school seasons by modern standards, where we are about to dive in here now on episode 2, essentially. And at the beginning of episode 2, not only has there not been a night one eviction, we don't have nominees yet. We've just gotten our first head of household. I think Big Brother is a game that benefits greatly from giving the players time to get to know one another before too much is really set in stone, game-wise. And this may actually, as we see these nominations play out over the course of week one, be kind of a counterexample to that general premise. But even with a relatively boring set of nominations here, I still feel like it is a general situation where this is extremely good for the game in terms of players having to make bonds essentially without knowing who they specifically should be sucking up to, which I feel like is something that it has been years at this point since we have gotten to see play out on like the modern season.
Yeah, this season only lasts for 81 days as opposed to the 100 odd that we have now, which really feels like a slug, especially given the quality of some of the recent seasons. And even when those seasons are good, it feels like you can basically tell what the stakes are and where the season is going early into it, by at least halfway through. And so that leaves you with a month and a half of just watching the inevitable play out on your TV and just seeing which one of those two or three different branches we end up going down. With this season, though, you are reminded in a way of just what a marathon Big Brother is compared to the sprint of Survivor, where Joe Barber next week is going to go out on day 20. And that's the day where, you know, in Survivor, we're gearing up for the merge vote, like this pivotal point in the game. Half the cast is already gone. We're getting to the jury phase. Here, we're going to see Joe go home, and then three more people are going to go before Dustin on day 48, you know, a week after the equivalent Survivor cast is left convalescing in their homes back in the US. He will become the first member of this season's jury, and that really just drives home how much of an endurance contest this game is, and how you really have to keep your composure, keep that mental fortitude going over such a long period of time. And I think it's a really underrated quality that the best Big Brother players are able to do that. And, you know, I wonder how many Survivor players who are kind of driven to their edge by the very end, and you can see them fraying around the edges and just about ready to snap and trying to keep it in, if you force them to be under the same psychological pressure for another 20, 30, 40 days, these people that we think of as great players who were able to hold their own, maybe they would have had some embarrassing meltdown and gone out themselves.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I definitely agree that classic kind of in air quotes Big Brother is almost more of a marathon than the modern seasons, even though the modern seasons obviously last a noticeable amount of time longer, just because, as I alluded to, it seems like virtually across the board, when the season kicks off with, all right, we want an exciting premiere where there's going to be some sort of big action happening, first of all, they lean pretty heavily in recent years on the like night one eviction, which is just ludicrous as far as I'm concerned. But at the very least, it seems like they always want a head of household by the end of the first night within the house. And when that is the way that they choose to kick off the kind of social game and strategic game simultaneously, it really does put the strategy into focus so immediately. And yes, on one hand, that certainly has its upside. You are going to have a lot more kind of instant drama within the house when the stakes are super clear right away and everyone knows nominations are coming soon and everyone knows who's going to be making those nominations. But I also feel like it's had a tendency to lock in alliances and potentially divide the house right away in such a way that the flexibility down the line is often much more limited than it is in the older seasons, where people had at the very least a few days to really get to know each other before the social game, or before, excuse me, the like strategic political game was really being played to its fullest extent. And I remember back in like Big Brother 2, 3, 4, they weren't even playing the first HOH comp until like day 4, day 5, and everyone had to spend the bulk at least of the first week socializing without having any idea who was going to be in power. And I think that really had a positive benefit on the mid and end game portions in particular.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I do think there is a lot of merit from a TV standpoint to having that figurehead elected or chosen or winning a competition, whatever the method is, on the first night, just as a nice thing to end that first episode on. And then you get to speculate, okay, well, I didn't pay much attention to that person until now, but what are they going to do? Who are they going to align with? How will people come to them? Is there anyone who's already in immediate danger? So I can see the merit behind that, just to get people talking, but it feels like it's just been taken for granted now and accelerated to kind of an absurd degree. But yeah, these episodes this season, at least so far, are very snappy, unlike this episode of our podcast, which, you know, as you're fond of saying, making terrible time. So let's dive into the episode here. We pick up with where we left off last time, where the house has just become aware that they have three intruders lurking in the upstairs bedroom. They're going to come down, introduce themselves, and all hell is about to break loose.
Yes, and at this point, by the way, we also know now that Kale is our first HOH, and those three intruders are going to be safe themselves this week. So it really is a kickstart to the political game relatively quickly, which I guess kind of invalidates a lot of what I just said, but it's going to be at least several days before she has to make nominations, and certainly no immediate decisions are going to be made here that are going to impact the way the game is going to, like, in a meaningful enough way, the way the rest of the game is going to go. But I guess we are technically going to have an HOH right away here, which I guess is worth noting after we just spent however long talking about the good old days. But yes, Dom, we get our big reveal. These three people come down the stairs. We talked in some detail last week about all of those reunions, and then right away I thought it was interesting in the beginning of episode two, they do go out of their way to highlight just kind of the early days of how everything is playing out within those relationships. So I did want to check in here, and in particular, one thing I'm sure we're going to be talking about this week and in many of the weeks going forward is just what a good job Dick and Danielle do of ultimately getting on the same page. And I didn't have a super strong memory of how quickly they were able to do that, but I'm guessing you noticed as well, and the people who, anyone out there who's rewatching this along with us, there are some, and probably much stronger than I had remembered, seeds here of Dick and Danielle being at least very open to the idea of working together. And Dick, from Dick's end in particular, I mean, he's putting it in no uncertain terms of like, my primary goal here is winning the love of my daughter back, and whatever happens within the game happens. And if I win too, that would be awesome. But first and foremost, I am here to do whatever I can to make Danielle want to talk to me again. And it does seem like even in these very early days, this is far less contentious than I would have necessarily anticipated.
I do wonder how much more or less extreme Dick would have been in his gameplay if Danielle just weren't there. Like, let's say either that, or let's say Danielle gets taken out, evicted, medevaced, or whatever, week one, week two. How does Dick's game change from that point forward? Part of me thinks that he would have just been really slamming his foot on the gas pedal and being even more of this assholish villain than he was already, because with Danielle in the house, he has to at least show some measure of restraint, knowing that his actions are going to rebound on her. The counter argument to that is, if this is what restraint looks like, I hate to think what Dick's going to do if the gloves and the mask come off officially. But maybe he would have, you know, dialed it back a bit. Maybe he would have been felt more able to just blend in, insofar as someone like Dick ever can blend in, when he doesn't have the massive target that being in that unique kind of pair poses to the rest of the house.
So something I said last week, and I'm going to stand by it here, but I'm certainly open to counterpoints if you would like to make them, or if anyone else on like the patron group would like to make them. I certainly am willing to acknowledge that Dick seems to have developed very strong bonds with certain people early on Big Brother 8, and that perhaps even the majority of the other house guests through the first week or two don't have any sort of active issue with Dick. But I would also say, and this may be influenced by recently watching ahead a bit and seeing a lot of his interactions in week two when Jen is HOH and he is on the block, it does just seem to me like there are always going to be enough people in any given Big Brother house that are going to absolutely loathe Evil Dick by the end of the season, because he's going to have just no chance of controlling what he says to them for any meaningful amount of time. And this is what I was I at least touched on last week, and would be curious to hear if you or anyone else disagrees. I am a pretty big believer that Evil Dick 1.0, even with Danielle there, but particularly without Danielle there, and for sure in a season without America's Player, is basically 0% to ever win.
Yeah, I don't know if Big Brother could ever really have claimed to represent a diverse cross-section of society, but given the types of people that the show can cast and likes to cast, even back here going on 13 years ago now, I don't know if that's good or bad for Dick, because, you know, each of them has many personal quirks and foibles that are easy pickings for someone like Evil Dick to just drill down on and, you know, and hammer those as much as humanly possible. At the same time, I think he needs people like that who are willing to kind of accommodate his the trashy side of his personality, where if you had like these more like buttoned up professionals or whatever, I don't know if they're taking kindly to Evil Dick themselves. So I do wonder what kind of cast Dick would be able to just succeed in a normal straight up game of Big Brother with. I don't know if this kind of cast is it. I don't know if there is a Big Brother cast that meets that standard at all whatsoever. But I think it will take something extraordinary for Dick to win. And we said, with the 1 week of gameplay that we saw in BB13, if that, it seemed like Dick was in a great position, but obviously so much can happen over the rest of that season. And that is unique as well by virtue of being a cast with half returning players who need someone to rally them. And it's so much easier for someone like Dick to intimidate newbies who are not just on the same playing field as him because he's a newbie himself, but he now has a whole season's worth of experience berating, torturing, intimidating that kind of player into following him.
And also getting the hero treatment from production,
yes,
I think is a very meaningful factor when you're one of the newbies on BB13.
You see that with the other players and also is the other veterans, sorry, and also some of the newbies on BB13. They say like, well, I'm terrified of Evil Dick, but I'm also a fan of Evil Dick. And I don't know if that second half would be true if they showed the true extent of his personality. But part of the pessimistic side of me thinks that it might be even more true if they showed everything. But who knows? But one thing that is worth touching on, I think, here is that Kale is our first HOH, and Kale is the second oldest person in this cast. He's the only other parent, the only other person who I wouldn't say culturally or personality-wise is close to Evil Dick, because as we see, Kale is a good, God-fearing businesswoman and housewife, and Dick thinks that he himself is God, so their cultural priorities don't really align that way. But there is something to the fact that, you know, Dick, who is 44 at the time of filming, Kale, who's 37, both of them have children. One of Dick's children is in the house with him and he's trying to reconcile with her. That's just a much more natural thing to bond over than, you know, looking over the ages of the rest of the cast. Danielle is obviously the youngest at 20, but the rest, we have Carol's 21, Joe's 23, Mike's 26, Nick's 25, Dustin's 22, Jonah's 23. Zach is the next oldest at the ripe old age of 30, and that, you know, he is the third oldest person in this cast. So I wonder if that was a factor too, just age giving them more to bond over, even if everything else they could bond over, they were complete opposites.
Yeah, Kale, as much as she may hate to admit it, may have genuinely found herself having by far the most meaningful conversations in the entire house with Evil Dick.
Yeah, and it's not like the rest of the house is giving him much competition there. There's not too much depth to a lot of those conversations, I would wager. But I have to think that that's part of it too. And Kale, it seems like, is going to fit in to the house early. It's like the non-threatening older woman who either is a lot to go out week one or tends to make it fairly far in the game. And it seems like Kale is going to be on the second half of things there. But she really overreaches too early. And with this week one HOH, she puts such a big target on herself and her group, which is just blatantly obvious to the rest of the house, that not only she, but the rest of them will all be evicted pretty quick. Aside from Zach, who I guess is able to recover and be this lone wolf for 40 days after Kale's gone.
Yes, we will shortly get into Kale and the whole formation of this whole Mrs. Robinson thing. I did want to just quickly add one last thing onto like what it takes for Evil Dick to win Big Brother as a first-time player. I think a lot of it is obviously America's Player being the twist in play and him kind of positioning himself against specifically Jen while also having this story going with Danielle. I think put him in the obvious catbird seat there in terms of benefiting from that for as long as he was able to stay in the game. But I also thought it is very much worth noting that, I mean, it seems virtually impossible to draw up a better set of circumstances for Dick Donato 1.0 than exactly what he found himself with in Big Brother 8. And even when every single thing went just about as good as anyone could conceivably draw it up, I believe, I have heard from Eric that had he not been literally contractually obligated to vote for and argue on behalf of Dick being the winner against Danielle, Dick would have been blown out in the final vote against Danielle.
Yeah, and retrospectively, people come up with all of these theories as to why Dick actually had a better social game than Danielle, or, you know, Dick was more respected because of X, Y, and Z, and so on and so forth. But the elephant in the room that has always been, he had one vote in the bag thanks to Eric, a second vote in the bag virtually thanks to Eric being able to convince Jessica through being so close with her, and then Eric also being as effective an advocate, as you could possibly ask for on Big Brother, to all of the rest of the voters, getting them right in his corner as well. So yeah, he really got bailed out on that one.
Yes. So to just quickly check in, because I did appreciate them kicking off episode 2 by showing us how things were developing with these pairs that had been so brutally reunited, I guess, in the Big Brother house. We have Dick and Danielle getting off to a very good start as far as I would guess both of them were concerned. On the other hand, Joe and Dustin seem to be going hard the opposite direction. We talked a little about this last time, and I'm sure we'll talk much more about this next. I guess actually there's some this week and plenty more next week as well. Joe and Dustin, it seems like, are just going to be oil and water as long as they're both in the house, no matter how it ends up going. The interesting one I thought was just Jess and Carol again continue to almost be treating each other like strangers who just aren't interested in getting to know each other. We don't, even in a week where Carol ends up getting evicted here, we don't get any sort of real dramatic scene between the two of them. We have them both, I think I remember one scene of them having some sort of like obligatory, hey, let's try to play nice, and wouldn't it be crazy if we ended up teaming up and running this house. I don't think either of their hearts was really in that. And one of the more notable confessionals for this for me this week was Jessica saying, quote, about Carol, by the way, quote, I don't like it when girls curl their hair with a curling iron, but it works for her, I guess, end quote. It seems to me like that was about the extent of what they could get out of either of Jess or Carol in terms of investment in this rivalry this season.
And that may have been Jess doing what she could for them and hamming it up,
maybe,
to make it, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe giving too much credit to Jess there, but yeah, it's like that. That's really the best you could give us, honestly.
Yeah, that definitely may be the case. It all these years later, still blows my mind that they thought Jess and Carol were going to be a particularly compelling kind of TV story. And as I'm sure we'll talk about as we end up losing Carol over the course of this week, it really seems to me like she just legit did not care about being there. I have heard from people that know a bit behind the scenes, or maybe this is out there in casting information that people have been talking about on, like, Jokers for years. But I guess, and this would certainly check out given the twist of the season, Carol was like actively recruited to be on the show. And so it would make sense to me if she showed up, obviously hated what they put in front of her, and said, get me the fuck out of here.
She certainly felt out of place. And I, on my first viewing, I remember actually quite liking Carol and then being disappointed when she just left in the first week. It felt like she had a lot more. And maybe this was just she knew better than to be shit-talking people in public the way that you're meant to do to keep Big Brother interesting. But it felt like she was kind of like had more grace than the rest of them. But maybe that's just me tricking myself because I found her cute or whatever. I honestly don't know.
Carol, if anyone is too good for the Big Brother house, it might be Carol. Yeah. Anyway. And
it's just so comical, especially given the stark contrast with Dick and Danielle and Joe and Dustin. I have to feel like anybody else in that house could have easily found a better rival for themselves than Carol and Jess. And I would wager each of Carol and Jess, especially Jess, just given how she comes off in the first week, both of them could have found a better rival for themselves than the other one. So the fact that it was two of them, it really felt like that one really missed the boat.
That is a really good point, because I've certainly thought about, like, wondering what they saw in casting that really compelled them in a season where they're only doing three pairs of people to say, yes, Jess and Carol are the ones we want to go with, I think you make an excellent point that how on earth does Jen not have someone that would hate seeing her walk through those doors if they were about to walk into, or, you know, if they had just walked into the Big Brother house themselves? Or I'm sure Amber has some crazy ex or something like that.
Nick has a whole queue of exes who are jilted by his fuckboy ways. I look, anyone in this cast, I mean, Eric probably, you know? I mean, lots of people like Eric. I'm sure Eric's had a few rivals in his time. Look, anybody in this cast, someone who, you know, didn't take kindly to Kale owning and running their entire small town, you know? Like, the possibilities are truly endless, and this is what we got to expect.
that it does become somehow even more puzzling over time. I somehow am further away from an answer than I ever was in 2007 or whatever. So we get check-ins with each of the three of those pairs, which I definitely appreciated. And also here, during some of these early character scenes, got to at least reference in passing, I would say to this day, one of the most kind of memorable early day character scenes in Big Brother history. Maybe this is specific to the kind of person I follow on Twitter or whatever. But I feel like a lot of people who have at least seen this season would have some memory of everyone. I guess it would have been going inside, like, after the HOH competition or something, and Jen gets to react to her memory wall photo. This is an all-timer for me. Dom, am I overstating this?
No, this is incredible, and it's incredible because it's so baffling. It seems like such an overreaction, and if this, you couldn't script this. If this was a comedic bit, it just simply wouldn't work, because you think, well, this just seems so, like, hammy and over the top and unbelievable. And yet there's Jen in all of her glory. And this is her first impression. This is her chance to introduce herself to the audience that's going to watch her for the next 3 months, and the cast of people she's going to be living with, hopefully, for the next 3 months. And this is how she decides to etch herself in their memories.
Yes. And by the way, not only this reaction to the memory wall, but also all of her Jen pun t-shirts. Dom, you have a very punnable name. I'm kind of now mad at you for not having a bunch of Dom pun t-shirts. But I definitely remember talking years and years ago at this point with Ian Terry about, you know, back when the idea
in the Ian Terry view.
Yes. about the idea of returning to Big Brother someday. And I was begging him to make his entire Big Brother 2.0 wardrobe just all shirts and famous wardrobe items that other people had worn on previous seasons, and have a bunch of, like, Jen pun t-shirts, or like a dolphin crash t-shirt or a suicidal tendencies t-shirt. You could honestly do the whole thing just out of Big Brother 8 people.
He could walk around in a skimpy bikini, showing off his curves. There's really a bottomless well of possibilities there. But you too also have a decently punnable name. You've got Colin Sanity, Colin the Shot. So there's, I feel like we've covered basically all of the possible puns on the show at this point for you. But with me, it's you couldn't really hope to exhaust them.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yours is just so flexible and easy to force into pretty much anything you want, whereas Colin, not bad, but requires kind of a specific set of circumstances. The possibilities really are endless for Dom pun t-shirts. I'm sure Johnny Fairplay would love to get a hold of you in terms of moving some merchandise. If you
could get pass on that one.
The intellectual property there. So we get Jen and the memory wall early on here. And then we also we get Dick gets kind of called out by Danielle and the rest of the house in the diary room for all the name dropping he's doing. Although I'm pretty confident, and I remember a few weeks from now, at some point, at least down the line, we are going to get a scene of on like one of the live shows, like a check in with people who know Dick in real life, and they're gonna at least say, hey, no, this guy is legit. He is actually that involved and somewhat known by the people that he claims to know. And I definitely do believe, by the way, that he like actually was Keith Richards' stand-in on Pirates of the Caribbean or whatever. Although I would add, if you're 40 years old and they want you to be the stand-in for like 65-year-old Keith Richards in a movie, you have made some questionable decisions, my friend.
I did read this week about this lady who is the body double for the Queen. So at every rehearsal for some royal event or whatever, she's the one who's there going through the motions on behalf of Her Majesty herself. And in some ways, that is an amazing, great job to have. On the other hand, if you are young enough that you can still not be retired and continue doing that job, whereas the Queen is, you know, in her 80s or whatever, still going strong, then yeah, that difference has to seem a little jarring at some point.
Yeah, I certainly have heard plenty about all the body doubles like Saddam Hussein famously had. It never really crossed my mind that the Queen would need a body double.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it sounds obvious when you say it, but it never really jumps out until then.
Who's out to get the Queen? What's in it for you to get the Queen? Who's taking down the royal family?
Nothing for me personally just yet, although if that changes, you know, maybe I'll have to start thinking.
The royal you, I guess, pardon the pun here, Dom. The layperson. What's in it for the layperson to take down the Queen?
Exactly. That's a very good question. But yeah, apparently Dick is entitled, I guess, to name drop all of these people, but does that mean that the people there in those videos saying that they know Dick, are they name dropping Dick and by extension those other people? Is there some like 6 degree of separation thing going on there?
Well, in case you missed it, Dom, a few years ago I was one-on-one chatting with Big Brother winner Ian Terry, just for the record.
Yeah, and Ian knows Dick, and Dick knows Keith Richards' stunt double, so yes, you're 4 or 5 degrees removed from Keith Richards.
Yeah, I guess so. So, Dom, let's get in now. I think this is right around the point where we do end up seeing Kale start to wonder what to do with this week one HOH power. And Mike is in her HOH room with her, and the two of them seem to be hitting it off pretty well. And they start talking about the prospect of working together, and fairly quickly, almost alarmingly quickly here, and a degree of speed that should perhaps leave you nervous if you were a member of an alliance forming this quickly. The Mrs. Robinson group seems to get together here with Kale as the, in air quotes, older lady, although 37, by no means old, obviously, along with Mike in the HOH room. Zach gets brought up to the HOH room, and then Nick never even gets brought up to the room to lock it in, like, in person with the rest of them here. I think it's just Zach fills him in later when they're both in, like, the storage room together that, hey, we were all in the head of household room. We really want you to be the fourth member of this alliance. Sound good to you? And they, like, shake hands, and it seems like a sturdy kind of situation for the short term. But we will certainly go on to see Nick not necessarily as committed to the cause, I would say, as perhaps the other people in this alliance. And I certainly am willing to acknowledge, by the way, the plenty of times, particularly on like Survivor, where the day one reasonably sized group alliance works out and we are able to kind of brute force our way to the end and then play down to this group. But particularly in the Big Brother house, it feels to me like these groups of four or more, with a few exceptions, of course, that form right away and under these sorts of circumstances can often do more harm than good in terms of painting. Yeah, you're going to be in power week one, but you're going to have this, word's going to get out. You're going to have an enormous target on you. And then you guys are going to be the focus for the next few weeks during the early game.
That's a useful trend to keep track of. And this Mrs. Robinson alliance may be one of the worst alliances of all time, honestly. Like when Mike is up there and making the alliance with Kale, he says, I know you have game. I'm sure Zach has game. None of these people have game. Mike doesn't have game. Nick doesn't have game. He has some type of game, but not the one that you need to do well on Big Brother. And honestly, the fact that Zach has might be the best player in that alliance is a damning indictment of that group. Like, if you took four people at random out of all the possible combinations of people on the season, I would say the vast majority of them would be a better, more functional alliance than this Mrs. Robinson alliance ends up being, which is weird because none of them are obviously like breaking down or like making these egregious mistakes. They don't seem like the types who are just going to implode their own games in an historically bad fashion over the first few weeks, but all of them do individually almost. Like, Nick digs his own grave, Kale digs her own grave, Mike would have been safe and potentially having a decent future in the game, I have to think, until he decided to just tank that for no apparent reason to stand up to Evil Dick. And then Zach, almost by not having enough social awareness or influence to do anything too bad, just skates under the radar for long enough that he outlives that reputation and is able to blend in again. We think about like the moving company and other alliances that disintegrated in that first few weeks, and even after all these years, the Mrs. Robinson alliance is still in that infamous company.
What was the name of the BB13 alliance where it was the four of them and they were literally the first four out? Yeah, that's got to be the benchmark. That's like the oolong of Big Brother alliances, right?
Yeah, I mean, I give them a little bit of leeway because I think any newbie alliance would have been targeted and broken up that way. And honestly, I'm glad that they at least made a go of it instead of just buddying up with the vets and then getting picked off at like final six, final seven when they outlived their usefulness. But yeah, in terms of just sheer results, it's hard to argue with that one.
Yes. I was wondering about Zach because he is going to go on to become kind of the person in the role that we have certainly seen go on to tremendous success in Big Brother seasons past and future. At the time of this recording, like the Will Kirby role in Big Brother 2 or the Dan Giesling role in Big Brother 10, like the person who gets their main alliance kind of wiped out early and then is able to work their magic in a lower key way and end up taking over by the end. I guess my question, Dom, is Zach someone we're overlooking in the greatest of all time debate?
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Hey, if I find myself in need of a contrarian take to argue later on in the season, that's the one I'm going to cling to. So hands off. Let me stay out of my territory.
Well, I mean, even without necessarily, I certainly don't know enough about what was going on the live feeds or when the live feeds were off or behind the scenes, and it's been a long time since I've seen this season. I don't want to undersell the effort Zach was putting in all season long or the ideas he may have had, but at least based on my interpretation, which may be totally off base, on June 6th, 2020, it seems to me like Zach, playing kind of a lackluster game, still came pretty damn close to potentially winning there. Like, if he wins the final HOH, I'm pretty confident he wins the game.
Yeah, or to go back to that decision at Final Five, like, if he does that differently, yeah, and then Final Four, Final Three, you lock those in certain ways, then, yeah, we're looking at Zach being the winner of Big Brother. And I wonder if he would go down as, like, the Josh Martinez before Josh Martinez. You know, he would have been one of the early prototypes for that. I have to think at the time, people would have regarded him as the worst winner, right? Like, up until this point, we had, for the game in its modern form, Will, who you can quibble with his BB2 game, but by BB7, he's regarded as one of the greats. Lisa, who I think people gave her short shrift at the time because they were so wedded to Danielle and Jason, but I think opinion has come around on Lisa, and they regard her as someone who played a very solid game in her own right. Then we had June and Drew, Maggie, and you know, all three of them, you might not like them individually or think that they're good TV, but they played one hell of a good Big Brother game. Then Boogie as the other Chilltown member in season 7. So if after that pretty good run of winners we had Zach, I think people would have wondered what the franchise was coming to.
Oh, no doubt about it. And credit to Evil Dick. I think he really does stand the test of time all these years later as one of the most questionable winners the show's ever seen.
In fairness, the very next season we have a baller who...
My boy. Not my boy. I'm not going to put that out there, but a character I enjoyed on the television program Big Brother.
Yeah, look, jailhouse antics aside, maybe not underrated in terms of his ethical agency, but as a Big Brother player, I think also gets more credit than he... deserves more credit than he gets. There we go.
He probably deserves more credit than he gets, and Big Brother 9 certainly deserves more credit than it gets, but I'm not really willing to put a baller in the territory necessarily even of actively above average Big Brother winners.
Sure, but look, that's a debate for another time. Okay. When our patrons, I hope, will have us follow up this with a nice little BB9 coverage.
Potentially. We'll see how the reaction to BB8 is a month or two from now, however long this ends up taking. Dom, let's get into our first food competition of the season. We don't necessarily need to spend a ton of time here, but this is kind of a Big Brother take on a classic Survivor competition. We certainly saw it in Borneo. We definitely saw it again in Cook Islands when Parv, Yule, and Ozzy won the spa reward. And then I was actually recently rewatching some Cagayan and forgot all about this moment. But Tony destroyed the mud transfer challenge in Cagayan. And so the mud transfer is essentially what we're doing here in the Big Brother house, except in this case, it is a novelty, and I mean novelty size, bucket of popcorn and popcorn butter squirter, and you're going to be transferring the popcorn butter on your body, and then your teammates are going to wipe it off and dump it into your team's bucket. First thing I wanted to note here from this challenge, Dom, is we get a confessional from Jess saying, "My team had all the big guys and also Eric." And when she pointed that out, I had a flashback to when they got the initial word about this challenge happening. They were all sitting in the living room and spaced out on either of the two couches. And right away, when they find out you guys are going to split into two teams, it is Eric Stein who is eager to say, "All right, let's just do it. This couch, just go right down the line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you're one team, and then I guess that's the cutoff, and then the other people are the other team." It was very funny to me to piece that together and recognize that in the dark, Eric was blatantly trying to stack his team for this challenge.
Oh, he was onto it right away, yeah. But as it turns out, Big Hair is going to defeat Big Guys in this challenge. Amber turns out to be the MVP. Not because she's especially athletic or good at the transfer or anything else, but she has the perfect vector, if you like, the perfect container for large globs of butter.
Yeah, which, hey, credit to Tony Vlachos, I guess. You know who's in need of more credit right now, Dom? Tony Vlachos for winning this challenge without much hair going on.
I was going to say, he's really fighting an uphill battle and managed to do it anyway. So yeah. Maybe we should have... being attuned to Tony's challenge prowess there and then, you know, the fact that he was able to swim uphill and win anyway.
Yeah, maybe so, Dom. I think there may have been a few things we might have overlooked in terms of Tony's prospects on Winners at War, potentially. But yeah, I think it's Dustin who has a great confessional at the end of this challenge saying, "We'd like to thank Amber's hairdressers and stylists and shampoos and conditioners for winning us this competition today." And I noticed, by the way, Dom, on the Thursday night eviction show, the real captain of Team Big Hair this season, Julie Chen. Julie, as always, by the way, looking good, but really got some high hair going on this season.
She's trying out some new looks, for sure.
Yes. So this is one of my favorite parts of all of week one now, coming up next, Dom. This is our first kind of deeper dive into what's going on with Joe and Dustin. We've certainly seen them at odds, but mostly in the form of campaigning against one another to other people within the house. We're finally going to get to see Joe and Dustin sit down on the hammock and hash it out, finally attempt at least to have a rational adult conversation. Does not necessarily go as planned. Dom, let's roll the clip here of Joe and Dustin.
Joe finally screws his head on right, and he figures out that we have to have a mature and rational conversation.
I don't want you here for this. I don't want this to be our time. I want this to be my time.
Joe, then who knows where this is going to go? But let me say this.
I shake thinking
about you. I shake like an epileptic at an arcade.
You cheated and gave me gonorrhea.
I did not cheat and give you gonorrhea, for God's sakes. Why won't you just get it through your head?
Dustin, you are someone, honestly, who I could have seen myself spending a long, long time with. And there's just one part of you that you just can't get over, and that's just, you're lying. You lie. And you don't open up.
I'm not a mean person,
yes, you are.
Joe.
You're a bad person who only is out for yourself. You never thought of me. You never did anything
Joe,
for
let me,
me
just say this.
The only thing you ever did for me is make me feel pretty.
He's the first person in my life who ever made me feel beautiful. But other than that, what a jerk. He's got to apologize for a year and a half relationship that was just bad news. He was a liar, just disgusting, despicable person. He slandered my name across Chicago, and he's very manipulative. He's very good at what he does.
I genuinely do have, I believe, a valid feeling that I have spoon-fed you your life.
You spoon-fed me my life?
Yes, you can do anything by yourself. I've raised you. I've been the parent that you never had.
I've known you for 2 years.
And look at where your life is.
This is something I deserve on my own accord.
It's not
at all. And it just
happened
to be something that you
did. Not at all.
Did.
Don't think that. Don't ever think that. And don't ever say that.
And if you had not suggested just playing the entire thing, I was going to. I was going to turn the floor over to the two of them, because really, no summary we could give could really hope to do this justice. And this is, in all of the craziness and the drama that's going to engulf BB-8, this is one of the most underrated aspects of it, looking back in retrospect. Like, this is intense, and it's kind of, it's great to watch, and it's fun to watch, but it's also terribly uncomfortable to watch at the same time. Like, this is vintage reality TV. Like, this is what people watch the medium for.
Yeah, that is an excellent way of putting it. Like, I am so captivated by what is going on between Joe and Dustin, but it also feels so wrong to watch what's going on between Joe and Dustin when there's no real reason for all of this to be getting aired out on national TV, not like literally aired in the television sense. But it's kind of like, because this is happening in CBS on primetime, that's okay. It's fine for me to feel better about myself by watching in on, you know, being a voyeur on this private conversation between two people who don't want to be here in the first place. But yeah, it is. I don't know if I've already used the word captivating, but that is how I really felt here, even all these years later, knowing it's not going to be a season-long storyline or anything. This is going to fizzle out relatively quickly in the grand scheme of the BB-8 narrative here. But, like, just that intensity between Joe and Dustin here I find riveting. And, like, I know this is definitely going to sound weird, and I would probably regret this becoming the case if it were ever the situation that I found myself in, but, like, I feel like I'm missing out almost on some dumb, twisted facet of life by not having anyone that I hate as much as Joe and Dustin seem to hate each other. Like, I feel like I'm being robbed of that sensation almost.
I wish I could redistribute my high school unpopularity where, like, 95% of people would like me more, but one or two people would like me so much less, and I could actually have an enemy or a villain or a nemesis.
that would be the dream for sure there, Dom. And I'm, you know, whenever this podcast does come to a bloody end, I'm sure Dom is going to be dragging my name throughout all of Chicago. But at least for the time being.
you see Eric's t-shirt, Maine, we've also got crabs. That's Colin's fault, people. Or, yeah, conceal some lines from Dustin. You know, Colin is very manipulative and he has gigantic nipples. You know, there's so much material I could drag up here.
God, I don't remember the exact words, but, like, that just closing sentiment of, like, you're only here because of me. Hey, no, I've earned my place, and you just happen to also be here. And he says, like, don't you ever say that, and don't you ever think that. Like, that is so cutting.
It is fucking brutal. And honestly, I'm sure this was incredibly uncomfortable for Dustin in the moment, but both in terms of his perception in the game and his portrayal on TV, this is almost the best thing that could have happened to him in terms of, like, Joe comes off looking like such a sociopath, for lack of a better word, and so extreme, and you're not really that inclined to take Joe's accusations of immaculately conceiving gonorrhea at face value. It feels like Joe is definitively the villain of this interaction. We see Dustin being comforted by other people and just, like, trying to explain the situation to them in the best way he knows how. Like, I think we see Danielle and Amber and a few others. And Dustin comes away from this week looking like he's the calm, sane, rational one, even though by the end of his own stint in the house, he would have had some really bad moments in his own right.
Oh, no, it's pretty incredible. I would say Dustin pretty unambiguously comes across as the party in this dispute that the average audience member kind of air quotes should be siding with. And I would imagine the vast majority of casual fans were Team Dustin if they were invested in that drama one way or the other. But I've definitely thought to myself before, and maybe this is just being super results oriented, but it did seem like even though Joe was there obviously actively campaigning to get rid of Dustin to anyone who would even pretend to listen, it may have been the case that Joe being there, shining that kind of spotlight that no one was paying attention to on him, was actually one of the better things Dustin could hope for within the game, as deeply uncomfortable, I'm sure, as all of the personal stuff was. It seems like as soon as Joe leaves, that's when the heat starts getting turned up on Dustin.
Right, and I think when Joe leaves, Dustin now feels more freedom to play his own game and almost make up for lost time and kind of goes too far over the line and then has to be reined in.
He may feel victorious, by the way.
What was that?
He may also just feel victorious, like, yes, I'm right and Joe's wrong.
Right, and honestly, again, if it hadn't been for Eric being forced to flip the house when Dick and Dustin are up on the block against each other, then Dustin stays, has a pretty solid alliance behind him, and maybe Dustin is just in charge of the game from that point forward. But, I think Joe being here, it is great to have that sworn enemy in the game because that's something that you can hide behind. You know, you can always... there's always a bigger feud in the house, and you know that Joe's going to put up Dustin, Dustin's going to put up Joe. You don't have to worry about them, and you know that other people will be worrying about them. But then also, if you have to pick a side, you're probably going to go with Dustin, because he seems like so much more sensible and calm and easy to work with compared to Joe, who, based on the way he's treating Dustin from the glimpse you can see, will gladly throw you under the bus at a moment's notice.
Yes, I feel like Joe may have been kind of serving as something we've talked about from the perspective of, like, survivor jurors. It could potentially almost be good for you to have for instance, there was someone I want to say, maybe it was Colleen, who at Final Tribal Council, when she was casting her vote for Kelly Wigglesworth to win the game, where whoever this person was casting a vote for Kelly Wigglesworth to win the game, made the announcement, like, I wasn't even necessarily going to do this, but Sue just came at Kelly Wigglesworth so hard that it actually sent me the opposite direction. I do wonder if Joe was almost that kind of presence within the Big Brother house for Dustin, where...
I believe that was Colleen and Jervis as well. I think the takeaway from that is that Sue almost hurt her own case, where she was so over the top towards Kelly that, okay, everyone knows that Rich has Sue's vote in the bag, but that flipped at least one, maybe even two votes towards Kelly. So it ended up just being counterproductive.
Right. And I think Joe may have kind of been the Sue there, helping Dustin almost by when all of the anti-Dustin stuff people are hearing is generally coming from the guy who blatantly has every reason to have an axe to grind with Dustin, it kind of diminishes your other reasons for considering Dustin a potential problem for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. All right, so this week one set of nominations, Dom, let's get into this. I know we spent a while at the top of the show talking about how much better it is for the game for people to spend more time without too much knowledge of who's going to be in power, or too much kind of political pressure to be scrambling immediately. Possibly a point in the other direction here for the opposing camp, as we see Kale, even with all of this time, it seems, at least based on the TV episodes, almost at a loss for ideas on whom to be nominating here. And what we ultimately end up seeing, at least as the TV explanation, is she goes with Amber and Carol because she and the Mrs. Robinson crew decide, hey, Amber and Carol were the first ones out of the head of household competition, and who can really argue with it if we say this is performance based, we had nothing else really to go on, where I like everyone, I didn't really know what to do, so it just ended up being Amber and Carol. Dom, I will admittedly pessimistically check in with you here. Do you know anything about what more was going on behind the scenes on the live feeds or whatever in terms of week one politics, or was it this kind of straightforward?
I have no idea, and as best I can tell, it was that straightforward. I think, as you said before, Carol just did not really want to be there, was not putting up much of a fight, and we see Zach, of all people, just begging Carol to like fight harder when she eventually decides to go around and ask for his vote. But yeah, the impression I get was, you know, that there was no clear set of targets, and Kale really had the freedom to decide which way she wanted this week to go, had a lot of good safe options. Like if she wanted to just keep her hands clean and get a nice drama-free HOH in the first week out of the way, she could have done this. You know, you could put up Joe and Dustin and let that resolve their dispute, you know, guaranteed to get one of them out of the house, probably Joe, and I think Dustin would maybe understand that situation if you had done that. Jen is emerging as someone that no one wants to be in the house anymore, so you could put her up against one of them, or you put up Jen and like either Amber or Carol or someone else who doesn't really have many connections, and then if Jen does go, that's fine, and if Jen somehow stays, you know, either way, that's a fine outcome for you. So it felt like Kale had to almost work hard to bungle this first week as badly as she did. And we hear so often that the first week in the Big Brother house is often the craziest, either where by the time the feeds have come on, we've already had 2 or 3 weeks worth of gameplay effectively in that first week, and we've missed so much and we have to piece together everything afterwards to try and make sense of it. Or you even get times like in BB Can 5, like Kevin was saying during his commentary in the rewatch, that first week looked to be pretty simple and straightforward until the last day or two, where everything blew up and the house almost flipped 180 degrees, and then everything just unraveled at the last moment and we went back to normal again. So there were none of those twists and turns here, as far as I can tell. It seemed like they really could have done what they wanted, and somehow Kale found a losing line nonetheless.
Right. It's almost as if making such a concerted effort to be like unobjectionable or apolitical or whatever you want to call it, fair and not pick sides, was itself something that put Kale and this, I think, this larger Mrs. Robinson group probably on people's radar, because I think they probably were not doing as stealth of a job as they may have thought they were doing. And what I would guess is a pretty troubling line to get from someone, especially early in a game of Big Brother, with whom you are trying to develop this good bond and potentially a relationship that you can both use all season long and potentially go the distance together, when they're not really giving you anything. And furthermore, when you have suspicions about them potentially being close with like the other members of this Mrs. Robinson group, and every single one of them is in like full on denial mode, I think that does way more harm than good, even when in their minds they're doing everything right in terms of not getting people on their bad side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there we end up with Amber and Carol as our week one nominees here, both initially and also after the veto. But I would say, like, this group, I think, is a perfect illustration of even when you take the most politically neutral line and the target that you end up wanting isn't close to anyone and she's happy to leave herself and everyone's more than happy to vote her out, the mere fact that Kale, Zach, Nick, and Mike come out of this looking like they may be working together is by itself enough to get them not just on the radar, but at the top of pretty much everyone else's hit list after a week of kind of vapid platitudes when any kind of decision making was the topic of discussion.
And this is after a week in which Kale puts up these two people precisely because, as far as I can tell, it's a good way to disguise the fact that she's now in this larger alliance where if, you know, she had put up two specific people, then you wonder, okay, well, did other people put her up to that? And what do they think about it? And if Mike is going around the house saying that, oh yeah, we should really get out Joe or whatever, then you wonder how quickly they ended up on the same page. Whereas if it is just, I put up the first few people out of the competition, then that seems like such a innocuous, innocent rationale.
But isn't it kind of too innocuous and innocent? Isn't that kind of like take a stand?
Yeah, I think invariably when people try to hedge their bets by saying, oh, well, it's just the first people out of the competition, that always ends up blowing up in their face as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some counterpoints to this, but I certainly back in the early days, I think it has become a lot more valuable in recent seasons winning the early HOH competitions and having people know that they have to spend like the first 12 days or whatever of the season living with you being the one making the most important decisions. But it did feel like back in the day, the people who were trying to make the most like apolitical nominations would often suffer deeply as a result when they would have potentially been much better served like actively trying to get a group together, even if it would be a bit obvious to the other people in the house. But I guess before we get into the power of veto, we should touch on a couple of fights that we have here. We've certainly seen some conflict, particularly between Dustin and Joe, but we're finally getting to the point where some of these people who were strangers about a week, week and a half ago are finally starting to go at it. First of all, as you have alluded to a couple of times, Nick is really hitting it off with a few potentially of the women in the house. He's bragging in the diary room about his top three favorite women to flirt with. And it turns out Jen is starting to feel like perhaps Danielle is getting a bit more of Nick's attention than she would like. Jen is telling a lot of others in the house how bad she feels for Danielle's boyfriend back home. And isn't it awkward that Nick's spending so much time now with Danielle when just a couple of days ago, Dom, he tried to kiss me on the mouth. And then Nick finds out from Joe that that Jen is spreading these rumors, and he confronts her about, hey, you're telling people I'm trying to kiss you on the mouth? I'm sorry, I love the way he says mouth.
Well, is that his natural accent, or is that his like enraged interrogation accent?
I think that is I think he's from like Minnesota or something. I think that is a solid kind of that area accent that I suppose I could have rolled the audio clip, but all of this has really just been building up to me wanting to say, you said I tried to kiss you on the mouth?
Yeah, and this, I think, if this happened nowadays or some like equivalent or similar situation, this would be a lot more incendiary. But at the time, it felt like it was almost because it was Jen saying it, no one took it too seriously to begin with. Everyone was already a little bit inclined to question her version of events. And so Nick is able to kind of clear his name without making it into an even bigger deal, and you're sparking the kind of uncomfortable discussions that would come with it. And I've always wondered in cases like this, not that Big Brother as an institution seems to really care whatsoever, but could Nick like go to the tape? Like, could he say to them, look, if I did do this and Jen was not okay with it, then that's grounds for discipline of some kind, at least. And given that you're not doing that, does that count as an endorsement from Big Brother that he didn't do that and that Jen's making it up? Or Like, given Big Brother's record, no, it doesn't. Right. But in an ideal world, that would be a tactic that you could use to, you know, exculpate yourself in that situation.
So I don't think that would necessarily work on Big Brother in 2020. I think that definitely wouldn't work, nor would it really even cross anyone's mind in Big Brother 2007. But yes, in case it hasn't been clear to anyone who hasn't seen this before, isn't rewatching, and doesn't have the freshest memory, it does appear that Jen is absolutely making this up, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So note that for your scorecard of this fight. And then speaking of Jen and other fights, as they are getting sequestered in the HOH room, the people who are not going to be competing in the Power of Veto competition this week, Jen and Dick, who are two such persons, are ready to go at it. In terms of tension has finally come to a head here. They are trapped in this room together for God knows how long, and Dick can't go outside and chain smoke. And they pretty quickly, at least on the TV episodes, get into it. And this is what I would categorize as at least our first, like, real classic Big Brother fight of the season between two strangers who have just had enough of each other, and at least one of them is screaming.
Mm-hmm. And I do wonder if Dick weren't here, just how, because Dick is at the center of a lot of the conflict in this season. I wonder if he goes, does the overall vibe change, or would other people step up to fill the void? You know, would Amber be getting into it with people? Would Jen step up her game to compensate for Dick not being there? Because we got to have a certain quotient of drama on this reality TV show, so someone's got to do it.
So that is definitely true, first of all, that Dick is, to blatantly rip off the Rob Cesternino-ism, the straw that stirs the drink here on Big Brother 8, but I have mostly chalked up his popularity with America to everything going on with Danielle and the clear fact that he would literally die to do anything to help her, not only in the game, but just to win back her affection in life. I still think he would be an enormous front runner to receive the bulk of the help from America over the season, even if he were nice to most of the rest of the people. But do you think that Dick's entertainment value played a big role in him getting so much support for, and so much kind of, I'm not going to say, like, fan worship from the audience, but how much of a role do you think that just, like, firecracker element played in Dick's overall popularity? Because to me, it's always been primarily the parent thing.
It's so hard to disentangle the parent thing from the entertainment thing. And it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. I don't know if Dick by himself is that much more entertaining to a lot of people than, you know, any of the other potential villains in the house. Like, is Joe or Jen or the others, are they that much less good from a TV standpoint? I don't think so. Whereas Dick is the only estranged parent that we know of in the house. And hey, who knows? Maybe 13 years later, some of these other people have had kids and become estranged from them, and Dick doesn't have that honor just to himself anymore. But at the time, that is the one thing that could swing a lot of the audience in his favor, and no one else can compete with that.
Right, and I'm sure there was a reasonable percentage of people who wanted to continue seeing Dick on their TV because of, in kind of air quotes, the entertainment factor. But I think it at least noticeably boils down to Dick going after Jen specifically so regular, and Kale probably at certain points so regularly, and other people that the audience would be inclined to be rooting against right away. I think it is yet another item on the laundry list of things that Dick had absolutely no idea could conceivably help him, and would on any other season of Big Brother be actively terrible for his game, but under these exact circumstances was perfect.
I also wonder, in the absence of any explicit thing like America votes to give someone a power or stuff like that, it is hard to know exactly how you're being perceived by the audience too, because anyone in the house who knows their Big Brother history, and I want to come back to in a second the idea of the Big Brother superfan, because I think that first gets introduced really in this season, and that makes sense. If you know your history, you've seen like BB6, where you have people on both sides confessing to these like terrible things and people just treating each other appallingly, and the fact that one side just gets lionized as the heroes, the other side gets painted as the villains. I think that is a fine distinction to draw by and large, but it brushes a lot of stuff under the rug. And then in previous seasons as well, there are a lot of things which, when you're in the house living with someone, not just personality quirks, but things they say and do, which you would think by any normal healthy standard would have them just excommunicated from polite society, and instead they end up just becoming well received because the audience doesn't know about them, or in some cases, like as Evil Dick will go on to prove, you can become popular because you are a bad person, because you're just acting like a massive asshole to everybody. So if I'm in there with Evil Dick, and like, am I going to assume just can I take it for granted that the audience must hate Dick, or am I thinking, hey, the audience actually might be in love with this guy and I need to completely recalibrate how I'm thinking about this entire house?
I honestly have no idea which direction I would lean with Dick 1.0, because I really would imagine seeing him interact in real time versus on edited TV episodes, I would come away with a far less glowing impression of Evil Dick, the hero of the people. At the same time, I'm sure I would be factoring in the whole estranged father and daughter storyline, although probably not to the same extent that the storyline on TV would be factoring that in. So I would guess the average person in the BB-8 house probably understood the possibility that Dick would be one of the popular characters as far as the fan base was concerned, but I would guess most of them came out pretty surprised at just how overwhelmingly popular he was.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. So let's do sidebar quickly onto the idea of this being the first real like Big Brother superfan experience in the Big Brother house. I assume you're talking about Eric Stein, who is set up in his intro package by his family when they go and check in with him on the big reveal that he's America's player, and we get all their reaction to that, which I'm sure we'll get into relatively soon. They reference, hey, you know, he's watched all of the seasons, he spent so much time thinking about exactly what he would do if and when he ends up getting into the house. How notable do you feel like this is within the course of Big Brother history, Dom?
I think he is the first of his archetype, basically. I struggle to think of anyone in the previous seasons who you really would put into that same mold, unless you have one that I'm forgetting.
I certainly don't have anyone who comes to mind as like a Big Brother super fan that I'm forgetting. I'm sure there were many people on BB4, 5, 6, whatever, who were enormous fans of the early seasons, but this is, as far as I can tell, the first time anyone's been set up during the very early weeks. It's like it's been this guy's dream his whole adult life to get on the show, the same way that we see down the line with like your Cochran, obviously, on Survivor, or like Ian, the aforementioned close personal friend of mine, Ian Terry, whose name I will never stop dropping, goes on BB14 and obviously has things go a bit better for him there towards the end game. I guess I've felt like because of Ian and Cochran happening relatively quickly, right? Ian, I believe, credits Cochran with being probably one of the main reasons he was cast on BB14, if that timeline makes any sense, and then they both win relatively near each other in just kind of the grand calendar of CBS reality. And then from that point forward, it's felt like, at least on Big Brother, the kind of super fan or the youngish guy who wears glasses has... I guess we had Steve Moses, and then those people start getting screwed. So it feels like Eric Stein has kind of been lost in the history, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, we had to sacrifice Cameron so that, you know, the others could pick up the torch in later seasons. But yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question, which is, we can't really think of many examples before Eric, but what's the next example after Eric? And it might actually be Ian Terry all of, what is it, 5-6 years later?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, this is the thing, is there's no question about it that, like, Dan Giesling was an enormous Big Brother fan. He just wasn't painted that way on the show.
Yeah, that's what I mean, is there's clearly no shortage of fans. And if you watch clips of the live feeds, you'll often see the fans talk about previous seasons. Excuse me. And especially in, like, All Stars, where not only do we have more clips of the feeds, but you have more people who, because they are former contestants, have like interacted with other alumni and who just in their own right are diehard Big Brother fans. Like, I'm sure Mike Boogie and Danielle Reyes could talk about past BB history all day, every day, right? But the idea of usually the young, nerdy guy, ideally with giant like horn-rimmed glasses to match, as the prototypical superfan, that really doesn't emerge until much later on in the show's run. And I guess that kind of makes sense, where when the show has been on for longer, there is more Big Brother history to be a super fan of. But the fact that we jump straight from Eric in season 8 to Ian in season 14 without really anything in between, and then we go like Ian, Andy, Steve Moses, you know, all in short succession, maybe with others that I'm forgetting, like, that is a pretty interesting like dip in the wave, I guess.
How about this? Maybe I'm mistakenly or erroneously, whatever, attaching the superfan label to someone who was not necessarily set up that way. But and forgive me, because it's been a long time since I have rewatched BB11. But how about Ronnie? Was he set up as a Big Brother superfan?
I think he definitely was. And yeah, that's the example that Big Brother superfans might hope to forget, you know? It's, Eric does great. Ian raises the bar even higher. Steve Moses is going to somehow keep it at the same level. Ronnie is the one that really, maybe the exception that proves the rule in those early years.
These years later, I think this must have happened before we ever even started podcasting together, Dom, but I still vividly recall a comment you made a literal decade ago, about how you would actually be okay with, it was either BB12 or BB13 being a returnee season just for the value in getting to watch Ronnie own himself again.
Yeah, I just put Ronnie on every season until, like, maybe he would learn eventually and you would have to find a new Ronnie. But until then, and that's probably years in the future, then just milk it for everything you can.
All right. So let's get into our week one veto here. We will certainly have more on Eric Stein, not probably in superfan terms, a little later when we check in on America's Player. Dom, we are going to get our hide-and-seek veto right away here in week one. And this is set up with, along with Jessica talking about Carol and her curling her hair, and I guess it works for her. My other favorite kind of like random hilarious quote from week one is when they're setting up the hide-and-seek veto competition, and Amber is in the diary room saying, "Yeah, my daughter and I play hide and seek, but it's honestly not my best game. I'm not a very good hider or a very good seeker." I love that quote ended up making air, that Amber's just like so nicely, I'm sure, in her mind, talking to this producer about just like, oh, you know, I love this game. I miss my daughter. And then they end up just like making her look like an idiot on TV.
It's a refreshing and somewhat surprising level of self-awareness from Amber, or really any Big Brother contestant. You know, it's in the grand scheme of things, this is maybe one of the more humble things that is said on a season of Big Brother.
Hey, yeah, it's very crucial on these sorts of games to know your own strengths and weaknesses here. Without, I don't think the specifics of who hid what where is really pertinent. We end up with Danielle Donato is going to be our week one Power of Veto winner. And I bring this up, this is certainly a stat I have referenced many times over the years on Big Brother podcasts and probably many other types of podcasts as well. This is just the beginning in terms of the Donatos and their competition prowess over the course of this season. I mean, I think it would be hard to dispute this being, other than maybe like Tom and Ian in Palau, like the most dominant pair of the allies competition wise that like reality TV has seen, frankly, in terms of monopolizing power in a given season. This is going to play out in such a way where over the course of all of Big Brother 8, and yes, I will, I am so interested by this that I will indeed roll through the entirety of it. There are only going to be 2 weeks where one of the Donatos is not either head of household or owner of the power of veto here. So Danielle wins the week one power of veto. Danielle wins the week two power of veto. Week three, Dick wins HOH. Week four is actually essentially the 1 week where the house had a clean look at the Donatos if they were so inclined. But this is right as everything is crumbling on the Mrs. Robinson of it all. So they were not really a focus there. Week five, Danielle, head of household. Week six, Dick, power of veto. Week seven, Danielle, head of household and power of veto. Week eight, technically they didn't win either of these, but it was Jessica. However, yeah, it was Jessica as head of household and Eric as power of veto, which essentially meant America had complete control and neither Donato was ever going to get touched. Week nine, Danny wins veto. Week 10, Dick wins HOH. Week 11, Danny wins veto and Dick then wins the final head of household. So Dom, they literally had one shot all season long to get a clean look at the Donatos.
Right. And we've seen like one or two examples across dozens of U.S. and international seasons, which are even in the same ballpark. And the one that comes to mind is Kevin and Dimitri's in BB Can 5, but they were sworn enemies. They were trying to get each other out. And that was what made their struggle so compelling, was that, you know, they were each other's biggest competition, and they were each other's biggest competition through the very end, just trading HOHs and POVs back and forth all the way through from the final eight, where each one of them won one or the other.
I did not know that. I didn't watch the end of BB Can 5, but that's incredible.
Yeah, so but even there, it's really not the same, where like the two of them are never going to be on the same page, whereas here you have two allies who don't just have the benefit of being as loyal as two people can hope to be in the game of Big Brother, where they're not just not strangers, they have the father-daughter bond, which maybe is less strong than it once was, but Dick at least certainly is going to do his best to repair that. So they have an implicit trust which no one else in the house can really guarantee, and then on top of that they have the most dominant streak in challenges of any pair in the history of Big Brother. And that's what I think in the grand scheme of things, when you think about BBUS comp beast, you think Janelle first and foremost, and then Rachel enters the discussion later on, like after BB13, and then Danielle for some reason gets lost in the shuffle, even though this performance in BB8 is maybe more impressive than any one of those singly, where she wins five vetoes and two HOHs, and that by itself would make her a dominant force to be reckoned with. And then Dick himself is no slouch either. He wins three HOHs and one POV. So between them, they are just cleaning up all of these competitions. And so even if all of the rest of the house were able to firstly play their own games for themselves, which is not true, and then secondly were all on board with getting rid of Dick and Danielle, it's just not that easy to do, you know? And I guess that there are times where, like, let's say one of them wins, you put up Dick and Danielle, only one of them can come off the block in theory, but you actually need to get the whole house on the same page with that, and that never happens, and you quickly run out of chances to do it.
Yeah, I definitely am on board with that. Danny in particular deserves to be in that conversation with the all-time great Big Brother competition beast. Janelle is, for my money, and I say this as someone who has not watched the more recent couple of seasons, but I would be pretty surprised if someone was in that same pantheon. Janelle is the GOAT in terms of Big Brother competitors you don't want to see out there if you need a veto to save your life or whatever. I definitely agree with Rachel Riley and Danny Donato being in that discussion. And then in terms of other notable Big Brother challenge streaks that come to mind, James Ryan being the veto king for a year or two in there definitely stands out. And then I also the other kind of challenge back and forth streak that I thought was worth kind of bringing up was Frank and Shane in the beginning of BB14, although that was much more, it sounds like a Kevin and Dimitri's thing, where it was, they were not necessarily working together. They were often actively working against each other. But the two of them, I remember as we were covering that in real time, they won something insane, like 7 of the first 9 competitions or something like that were won by either Frank or Shane.
That's a good call. If it's true, which I also remember it being, and I say this in a very circuitous and tortured way because it gives me time to Google this and to go down that for myself, but without the kind of dead air or lulling conversation, that would make it awkward if I were to do that. So here we are. I am on the page. This whole chart is a little messed up because we have like the coach's competition and the coach saving people also in there. So it's all like bloated and hard to read, but just at a quick glance. Okay, week 1 Vito, Shane. Week 2, Frank wins HOH, Shane wins Vito. Week 3, Shane wins HOH and Shane wins Vito. Week 4, Danielle wins both. Week 5, Frank wins HOH and Vito. Week 6, Shane wins HOH, Frank wins Vito. week 7, Ian wins HOH, Frank wins Vito. And then week 8, Frank wins HOH, and then Jen and Ian win the veto. And then week 9, finally, neither of them win. Frank goes out. And then I guess Shane notches out one more veto win in here too. But yeah, those first few weeks, that it's the same dynamic. They just go back and forth. And this is with, 13, 14 people in the house, which is stunning.
Now I need to pull up the Big Brother 14 Wikipedia myself. There's some crazy statistic about... here we go. I am on it. I am not letting any dead air come in here as I am scrolling down to the competition results. There's some crazy stat here about like only X number of people won either HOH or Vito over the course of like, and it's like only Frank, Ian, Shane, Danielle, that like those four won all but like 2 or 3 competitions of the entire season.
Mm-hmm.
It's some crazy stat in terms of this small group of people winning every competition in BB14, but neither here nor there in terms of how things are going to impact the BB8 week 1 veto situation here. Danielle is going to get it. She is not going to end up using it, and we're going to get a pretty straightforward vote against Carol here. So the Thursday night episode, I think we can get through pretty quickly, but let's definitely touch on a couple of things here. Let's check in with a name that I'm actually surprised hasn't come up a bit more, at least to this point in this podcast. We talked about him in the superfan capacity, but let's check in with Eric Stein in terms of being America's player here. And gotta say, week 1, if we're just going to take a snapshot looking only at this, I'd feel great about being America's player here after just 1 week, where his first assignment is he has to make up a fake kind of traumatic story and bare his soul to whichever house guest America decides. He ends up having to give some sort of sob story to Kale about how Danielle is triggering memories of some ex-girlfriend he had. That goes as planned. He gets to, you know, give the knowing wink to the camera as he's in the middle of the hug with Kale, the same way we get to see years from now Dan Giesling do with Jesse Godders as he's hugging him in the storage room there. So that gets the check mark. And then assignment number 2 is, hey, all you got to do is vote to evict Carol. Everyone else is very on board with evicting Carol. Carol's ready to leave. This is going fantastic. Dom, free money here being America's player.
Yeah, everything's coming up Stein at this point.
Yeah. And then I love when we get our Thursday night kind of home check-in packages with some of the people that have been the bigger characters in this opening week. We go meet Eric's friends and family who are having their big premiere night watch party. And when they see the footage that we're going to find out who America's player is, and Eric walks through the door, they react like it's the Red Wedding on Game of Thrones. They're all devastated that Eric has to be America's player.
And for good reason. Yeah. They know what the deal is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Eric, credit to Eric's brother. He was all over it. It was at least presented as if he was saying these things in an interview prior to knowing that Eric was going to be America's player. But he was pretty firm, saying, I think it would be terrible. It'd be the worst thing Eric could ask for to be America's player. You know, he knows exactly what he wants to do, and this is going to screw everything up. So credit to Eric's friends and family for being on top of that one there. We also, Dom, on top of getting to meet Eric and the people in his home life, we also get some backstory on everything going on with the Donatos and how we got to this point. And we get to meet not only Dick's son / Danny's brother, Vincent, we also get to meet Dick's mom, Grandma Donato, who hilariously calls him Richard the entire time, by the way, which I love and am tempted to do so myself if it weren't going to be so confusing.
That is absolutely what I would do if I was one of his many estranged children, just trying to kneel him. It's just a free way to get under his skin.
That is a fantastic call. If any of his estranged children are listening, that's a freebie for you right there. And this is where we get Dick giving the line in a confessional kind of woven into this package, saying, quote, I have the hardest game in the house. I have to win the game and I have to win back the love of my daughter, end quote. And if there were any doubt about Dick being one of the front runners to benefit from America's player all season long, or at least as long as he was in the house, I would say that quote put him over the top.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So I guess let's get into just parting thoughts on how this vote ended up going down, or I guess parting thoughts on Carol, or just general thoughts on how this vote ended up going down. We see a 10-1 vote against Carol. They don't even show us, by the way, who the one vote was against Amber. They are still at the point in Big Brother history where not all of the votes are being cast live on Thursday night episodes. We're getting the montages and cliffhangers and such, only revealing a couple of choice votes at a time, and they don't even show us who the person is. Julie sets it up as, hey, tune into the early show tomorrow and you'll get the exclusive look at who it was who ended up casting their vote against Carol. It ends up being Jen. So I guess note that for your scorecard. It's actually funny. In a follow-up scene, it's either next episode or sometime in at some point in week two, when Jen is explaining her decision making there to Amber and Jess, she says to Amber, no offense, but like, why would I vote for you to stay if I've never talked to you? And Jess says, as they're both in the room together, yeah, and like, you know, it would suck for Carol to leave in a unanimous vote. And Jen responds, oh yeah, that's a good point too. I honestly should have just said that instead. So not a whole lot, I would say, to get into here in terms of the strategic fallout. But Dom, any thoughts from you on this vote or on Carol leaving?
We miss you, Carol. We love you. Hope to see you back again soon. But no, this vote really speaks for itself and is straightforward, although props to Jen for trying to instill a little bit of pointless drama in there too.
Yeah, and I guess that is going to bring us to the end of week one, aka the end of Carol's journey. So, and by the way, parting thought on Carol, I don't know, you may have been there too for this, Dom. It's some recent, and I say recent meaning within the last couple of years, I have no memory of exactly which one it was. At some recent RHAP Live Know-It-Alls, they did also a Big Brother episode the night before at some different club, and Carol, of all people, was either lives in town or was just in town, and Eric Stein was there, and he shot her a text and got her to swing by to the event. And I don't know what the full backstory on how all of this went down was, but it at least seemed to me as an audience member that when Carol showed up, like, I don't know, 15-20 minutes into the show already being underway, and Eric was on stage with Rob and like somehow made it known that like, oh hey, another special guest has joined us, it at least seemed to me like Rob clearly did not know who this was. And Rob goes, all right, yeah, hey, welcome. Eric, why don't you bring her on stage? And Eric goes, no, you got it. And Rob's like, no, really, you know, it's your friend. I would love for you to have this opportunity. And Eric goes, No, you go ahead. Like, clearly leaving Rob just, like, completely hung out to dry. Rob eventually got there and figured out it was Carol Drake. Maybe he knew the whole time, but that moment of, it seemed to me like Eric recognized Rob is now on stage in front of hundreds of people, totally at a loss for words of what he is going to say when he has to make it clear that he doesn't know who this person is. I thought that was both extraordinarily cruel, but also hilarious. I would die if I were in that situation, but it was very funny as an audience member.
Are you familiar with the panel show What's My Line?
I'm not familiar with it, but yeah, I would love to find out more.
Okay, it's fair enough that you wouldn't be, because it was discontinued. A solid, doing the math, maybe like 16, 17 years before you were born, depending on when you were born.
I was born in like 1963, so...
No, you were born in, I'm going to say, 1988?
Seven.
Okay, so 20 years. All right, so fair enough. But basically, the premise is that you had, and this was filmed in black and white to give you a sense of how old this was, but you had this panel of celebrities, and these strangers would come on, and they would have to figure out who this person is, like what's their occupation, what's this unique feature about them. So I remember one of them was this old guy who, this episode was like 1953, and this guy was in his 80s or 90s, and he was the last surviving witness to the assassination of Lincoln. Like there at the time, and so that got like some gasps from the panel, and so that's the theme. It's like you have these people who have this fascinating secret or aspect to them, and you have to figure out what it is. And I'm just imagining the same thing going on, but like this random like attractive woman is just like shooed on stage by Eric's side, and Rob's there thinking, I have never seen you before in my life. But I know there's something about you that Eric is wanting to do this for this bit. And now I'm like running through my Rolodex trying to figure out exactly who and why.
So I do not know. Rob did, after like three or four laps of trying to get Eric to introduce her, he did. I don't know if he knew the whole time or pieced together that it was Carol, but like I was so dying to see how that would have played out if he just never figured out who it was and if Eric would not give it to him.
Eric, look, Rob is enough of a professional to just go along with it and assume, look, there's like a 70% chance this is a Big Brother contestant of some kind. Let's just get their thoughts on this and pretend this is a normal occurrence.
And I believe Carol also said that Eric had like presented the situation to her as, hey, a couple of us are grabbing drinks at this bar. You should come by. And then she walks in the door and immediately gets brought on stage.
You know, maybe this is one of Russell's dumb girl alliance from Samara. This is one of the girls from Caramoran or Guatemala. You know, there are so many people it could be. That they must be involved in reality TV in some way.
Yeah, and by the way, this is another memory. We can wrap this podcast up soon, I promise, Dom. I remember at that podcast, I'd forgotten all about this, but we were sitting near the front, and somehow, like, as Rob was bringing on all of the Big Brother people who were going to be there on the panel, they were walking right past me, and as they would walk past, I would reach out and give each of them a high five. When it was Eric's turn to come out, I saw him noticeably switch his beer into the other hand so he could not be high-fived, which I thought was a very strong move. I thought that was a very good move. Anyway, one actual final thought on Carol, and I mean this completely sincerely. I feel like Carol got away, I think, and I say this knowing nothing about Carol or the fallout from Big Brother or anything beyond this moment for how her entire life ended up playing out. But like, in the grand scheme of people who go on reality TV and are the first one out, I feel like Carol came away from this better than at least 95% of people who go through that experience. It seems to me like she was genuinely never really that interested, and that's probably exactly where you want to be if you're going to be the first boot.
It's like that saying that all political careers end in failure, and you know you just have to try and end yours by your own hand, by your own agency, before it's ended for you. And like for Carol, yeah, okay, you're the first boot, but that means you didn't have enough time to embarrass yourself on national TV. And then also, had she stayed for long enough, she surely would have been the target of some like psychologically scarring tirade from Evil Dick that she definitely would not have deserved. So I'm glad for her sake that she got to dodge that as well.
Yes. All right. So there goes Carol. Dom, we are going to move on now to week two. And I think before we wrap things up, let's get our week two head of household here on this Thursday live show. We are playing Majority Rules, a classic Big Brother competition until I actually think it was Big Brother 11 where they ended up like hacking it, and then they did the same thing on Big Brother Canada where like the big alliance all agreed like, hey, if it's majority rules when we go out there, everyone just always put A or always put B or whatever, and we'll all definitely make it to the tiebreaker. In this case, this is before the game was broken, we do still get a four-way tiebreaker here between Dustin, Eric, Jen, and Joe, and as usual, Dom, in the tiebreaker, the answer will be a number. Whoever puts the closest answer without going over will be our new head of household. And our question this week, how many gallons of water does the spinning teacup chair in the backyard hold? This is an oversized teacup where at least three or four people can sit in it and spin around. How many gallons of water do we think this thing ends up holding if full? Three of the four people put several hundred, one or 200, because this is a pretty decent-sized cup here. Jen ends up putting 41 gallons of water, and it turns out, because of the entrance where people get in and out of the teacup actually only holds 9 gallons of water. If you were to just pour a shower of water onto the teacup, so sorry, everyone who thought we meant if it were a full whole teacup. We mean literally this teacup with the giant slit in it. Jen, congratulations. With an answer of 41, you are our new head of household. So, first of all, perfect kind of chaos result in terms of it really seems like any relationship anyone has with Jen, it seems to be mostly contentious. I don't know if I could point to anyone being a tight ally of Jen's at this point. So this is going to be quite a treat there. But Dom, what did you think of the teacup question? Is that fair in your mind?
You play stupid games, you win stupid prizes. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, I am totally cool with the teacup question. I have no problem with that sort of technicality being something that they include, and you know, if someone did have the like lateral thinking or whatever to put a very low number, I would have been annoyed if they had said, hang on, there's a giant slit in the thing, obviously it doesn't hold hundreds of gallons of water. I would have felt like someone had been screwed if they had put like the correct technical answer and the producers were the ones who overlooked it in the opposite direction. So this is not at all to me anything out of bounds. So Jen now going to be our week two head of household. Very excited about that. And by the way, when they asked her about her strategy for how she landed on the number 41, they said, oh, were you thinking about it in terms of with the slit, or were you thinking the whole teacup? And she says, oh, I wasn't thinking at all. I was just writing down a number. So 41 seems like as good a number as any. Jen Johnson is our week two head of household, and we will be getting into all of that and much more, I'm sure, Dom, next week. Until then, I have one final question for you, and I don't need an answer here, but if you have one, I would be very curious to find out what it would be. Through this first week, who, if anyone, has like pleasantly surprised you? Who has stood out beyond what you were expecting here through the first week of this rewatch?
I don't know that anyone has had the time to surprise me yet. What I will say, now that I have the floor for one final time in this episode, is it was so nice and so refreshing to see the spinny key wheel again. I missed that goddamn box so much. And you know, that's when the innocence really left Big Brothers, when that was removed for a far more efficient and time effective but less heartwarming method.
So I 100% agree with that. I did see someone in the patron group make the counterpoint that, like, you know, the spinny key wheel in the modern cast where they have 16, 18 people in the beginning weeks, it definitely would take forever. A lot of the time now, and I get why they want to kind of expedite that process. I am not saying that the downfall of Big Brother is because they got rid of the spinny key wheel, but I do think a very clear line in the sand can be drawn between the quality of BB2 through BB15 in general and BB16 and beyond. And that is exactly, I believe, when they got rid of the spinny key box. And maybe that's a coincidence, but maybe not, Dom. That's all I'm saying.
I'm not going to believe that's a coincidence. You can't convince me of that.
Yeah, I'm open to the possibility that the spinny key box was the secret sauce all along. So there we go with week one of Big Brother 8. Because I have been able to watch some of these, all of these episodes back on YouTube, instead of having to switch to CBS All Access until week three or four, when those YouTube clips are gone, I have actually gotten to see the original, like, recorded straight from the CBS feed version of these episodes rather than the ones on CBS All Access that have certain things digitally removed. So fear not, I am noticing on the lower thirds, we do have some very compelling coming this fall candidates that I don't think we need to get to this week. I think it would be smarter to save those for things with less going on, but definitely aware of those and looking forward to that. I will say this week, as far as the lower third is concerned, Dom, we get so many prompts every episode that pop up telling us to text FAN to 99888 for exclusive ringtones and wallpapers for our cell phones, Dom. I don't know what would happen if I texted FAN to 99888 right now, and I'm not interested enough to pay whatever $10-ish charge would probably be incurred if I did do that. I am very curious to know, though, what would happen if someone were to text FAN to 99888 in the year 2020. So if anyone hearing me wants to do that, I would be interested in finding out the result. That's all I'm saying. I'm not pressuring anyone to do it. If you were equally interested, or perhaps more interested enough to actually do it yourself, I would like to hear the results. All right. So
all I'm saying is we have given out free monthly subscriptions for far less. So I'll just put that out there.
Yes. All right. Dom, anything else from you this week?
I think I'm good for now.
All right. I am as well. So, and by the way, I think this will now conclude the episode that is going to be going up on the main feed a couple of weeks from now. So if you are hearing this and you enjoyed it and you want to come along for the rest of the ride, patreon.com/DomandColin for where the rest of this is going to be happening for, I don't want to say all summer long, but however long this ends up taking us, patreon.com/DomandColin is the place to go if you would like to get on board for that. So yeah, thank you guys for making it this far. Looking very much forward to getting into week two and everything that is yet to come. I am really loving this BB8 rewatch to this point. If nothing else, a very welcome distraction from everything else that is consuming us so many hours every day. Not that those are not extraordinarily valid things with which to consume ourselves, but not bad to have a break from time to time. So we will talk to you, I'm sure, very soon. Take care, everybody.